and gentlemen to the War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this Tuesday afternoon. Hope everybody's doing well. Middle of this December, we have an absolutely huge show for you today. We're joined by Andrew Branca in the third hour. He is just an absolute wealth of information. We'll be getting into all sorts of political conversations, political topics with him, where we are on a lot of the legal pursuits of the Trump administration. Very excited to talk to him about a huge number of topics, including how we can get rid of some of these judges that are foiling everything that Trump is trying to do. We got lots of videos to get to as well. Also, this story came out yesterday, and I talked about it a little bit, but it continued to dominate the conversation last night, The Lost Generation by Compact. So I went through this, and I got a bunch of contributing material to it. So I want to talk about not just what the effects have been in on the psyche, the mentality, the economics of America following the Black Lives Matter insanity of completely discriminating against white people openly. I want to talk about the consequences of that, but I also want to talk about where it really came from, how this was, and we'll get to it. I got to get to the Daily Dispatch. We got a lot of stuff to talk about and not a lot of time to get into it. So let's begin today, as we do every day, with our Daily Dispatch. All right, here it is, folks, your Daily Dispatch for Tuesday, the 16th of December, 2025. Hunt for Brown University gunmen starts anew as tension rises. Yes, that's right. They're starting the investigation over, I guess. The new focus on the of the hunt for the Brown University shooter appears to be a stocky person of medium height who hours before the attack was walking a few blocks from campus in dark clothes and medical mask. Officials released surveillance video and photos of that person late Monday afternoon, trying to generate leads in the two-day-old investigation after detaining, then releasing a 24-year-old Wisconsin man who they'd initially described as a person of interest. And I actually believe we have a suspect's name, if I'm not mistaken. There may be some updates about this from just a few minutes ago, if the crew can check on that, because I did see people investigating a particular name. In fact, I'll follow up on that beginning of the next segment. Meanwhile, Zelensky and Merz hail NATO-style U.S. security guarantees as real progress in peace deal. We've heard all this before, but Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and American officials are hailing progress after deep discussions on a peace deal to end the nearly four-year war with Russia. During a couple days of meetings in Berlin, U.S. officials have said there's consensus from Ukraine and Europe on about 90% of the Trump-proposed peace plan. It could be finalized within days in order to present to the Kremlin, which is unlikely to go for any scheme which doesn't feature serious territorial concessions. Zelensky late Monday said the draft is very workable, but the key questions remain unsolved. So it does seem like we are plodding our way towards peace in Europe, but not if the Europeans have anything to say about it. We'll get back to that in just a little bit. The FBI repeatedly warned that the DOJ did not have probable cause to raid Trump home, had not been corroborated. Bombshell emails have been released showing that some inside the FBI were skeptical of the Biden DOJ's push to raid Trump's Florida resort home. The FBI in summer 2022 raised repeated objections to raiding Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida, warning agents did not believe the Biden Justice Department had enough evidence to establish probable cause, and the then former president had broken the law in handling classified documents, according to the bombshell memos turned over on Tuesday to Congress. We can read those memos a little bit later. But yeah, essentially they had no probable cause because, you know, it was a purely political act of malice and repression from the opposition, to the opposition party from the ruling party. Meanwhile, Pentagon elevates probe of Senator Mark Kelly as scrutiny grows over boat strikes. The Pentagon has upgraded its review of Senator Mark Kelly's unlawful orders video to an official command investigation, per the Washington Post. As a retiree, he's subject to the UCMJ. His lawyers call any action unconstitutional. He's allowed to break the law with impunity, actually. Oh, you're getting probed, Senator Kelly. Senator Kelly, I regret to inform you, the probe is increasing its depth and scope. Finally, tensions were thawed. Candace Owens and Erica Kirk had extremely productive meeting because apparently right-wing women are some sort of mafia that has to have sit-downs every once in a while.
Introducing Ultra DNA Revival, the advanced daily supplement designed to help you feel and perform at your absolute best, starting at the cellular level. Backed by cutting-edge mitochondrial and DNA support science, Ultra DNA Revival delivers noticeable all-day energy without stimulants or crashes, faster recovery and greater endurance, sharper focus and mental clarity, support for healthy blood sugar levels, stronger immune system function, enhanced liver health and natural detoxification, reduces everyday stress and anxiety, protection against oxidative stress, and the visible signs of aging. And again, this is a private label of an already best-selling brand that found this. Thousands of customers report feeling the difference in as little as 7 to 14 days. Right now, take advantage of our best pricing ever. VIP members, $34.95. Regular, $59.59. Save over 40% with a VIP membership for $30 a month. Experience the revival your body has been waiting for. Secure your DNA revival today at TheAlexShowStore.com.
You're watching The War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now on X.com.
Annihilate.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. What did I say I was going to get to as soon as we came back in? I started talking about something and then I decided I didn't have time. No time. We do have just so much to get into. I think we'll start with, oh my God, where do we even start with? The terror attacks, the shooting at Brown University that's still unsolved, the shooting on Bondi Beach in Australia that is serving as the catalyst for all sorts of horrific and repressive and censorious activities by the Australian government. I think we'll start with the Antifa cell. The Turtle Island Liberation Front that was busted by the FBI as they claimed that they had plans to plant four explosives around the Los Angeles New Year's Eve celebration, trying to commit a terrorist attack there. And I have more evidence that I pretty much nailed this as soon as it came out. And I know I've explained this in bits and pieces before, but maybe I need to lay it all out for you, because there is a new video that they've released. We'll go to clip number three here. This is the FBI revealing footage from a surveillance plane showing the four accused Antifa members setting off a bomb in the desert as a test run. We'll go to that video here and then explain to you how it is. How is it that the FBI had a surveillance plane above the subjects of this investigation? Obviously, they knew what was going to happen, almost certainly because they themselves set up the test in the desert and the explosives. We'll get into why I think this and how this plays into the modus operandi of FBI as they simultaneously and debatably investigate terror plots while also being actively involved in starting and continuing them. I'll explain how this works on the other side. First, here's the FBI explaining and showing some of the surveillance footage that they got of this Antifa cell trying to make bombs to blow up Americans. Let's watch.
And this is the video is, do you want to describe the video?
Yeah, I'll describe the video. So as I mentioned in my talking points, on December 12th, a group of individuals, again, members of this anti-government group, traveled out to the desert to test their explosive devices. They had precursor chemicals there, and they were going to create these bombs in the desert. What they are starting to do is put their chemicals and wares and the components out on the table there. This footage that you're watching is from our surveillance plane, and then what happened after this is the Los Angeles FBI SWAT team, along with the FBI's hostage rescue team, moved in and arrested all four subjects without incident.
So now we'll take some questions.
You mentioned these five companies. Can you get more specific about
that? Yeah, we're not naming the victim companies, but I'll generally describe them as logistics centers. You can think of like Amazon-type logistics centers, but we're not naming the specific companies at this time. There were at least five locations that they intended to target within Orange County and Los Angeles County. Again, we're not giving out the specific sites, But they were willing and wanting to do more if they could recruit more members to their radical efforts there.
You mentioned the arrest in New Orleans. Do you think that there are other people involved?
There are definitely more members to this group. As far as who was specifically involved in this New Year's Eve terror plot, we believe we've arrested all the members who were specifically involved in that particular plot. We did execute search warrants to people who are also part of this group. As we review that evidence, if we determine that there are any other individuals who knew about this or provided any assistance, we will obviously be charging them as well.
So hopefully we see this investigation expand and not just the people actively caught with the bombs, you know, in the desert trying to test them. Hopefully they won't be the only ones rounded up for this, because obviously they were just one group that was actually a splinter faction of a larger group with a bunch of ridiculous names. But it's sort of, you know, evidence that they are, in fact, a group, like they're a or like a conspiracy. You almost might call it a conspiracy. It's almost like you could use RICO charges to get everybody involved in the planning or the discussion or the secrecy around it. Hopefully it's not just these four people, although it is good to see these four people at least be held responsible for this. Now, again, people were asking, how did the FBI have a spy plane directly above these people ready to film them as they were testing their explosive devices? And the answer almost certainly is because the FBI themselves invited them out to the desert and provided them the explosive devices. Now, I'm not exactly saying this is something the FBI shouldn't do. It's just this is their modus operandi. This is exactly how it works. And again, I've explained a particular case like this where it was a guy who was like a sovereign citizen type. His bank, his house was being foreclosed on by the bank. This decision was made by some district attorney or some judge. Somebody who, you know, some municipal authority, and this guy wanted to blow him up. He wanted to bomb him at his courthouse. And so he goes to his nephew, who's an explosives expert, and says, you know, you need to help us. Recruits him into his sort of sovereign citizen militia group. And of course, the nephew pretends to go along with it, calls the FBI and goes, I think we have a problem here. The FBI says, it's fine. Go along with him. Go along with it. And in fact, when it's time to actually go test the bomb, we'll give you bombs to take out and test. And again, this is all about securing a conviction, because you can't just arrest people and say, trust us, they were going to bomb somewhere. You have to show that they not just were thinking about it, weren't just interested in the idea of bombing people. You actually have to give them an opportunity to think that they are bombing somebody. So then you can guarantee the conviction. You can go, look, this person planted what they thought was a bomb, got out the phone that they thought would detonate the bomb, hit the code that they thought would detonate the bomb. Lucky for us, we, the FBI, provided the bomb. It was inert, but that's what they do to, you know, get the conviction. So here it looks like they raided them during the testing phase, which I guess would be adequate. I don't know. They thought they could get the conviction based off this. But that's almost certainly what happened, is that early on, somebody in this Turtle Island group probably reached out to everybody else in the group and said, we're thinking about doing this. Somebody in that group thought, gee, if they really pull this off and they investigate it and they find out that we knew about it, we could be held liable. I'm going to go turn this into the FBI. And we actually have confirmation of this. So, again, you know, it's like it's not the FBI shouldn't be doing this. This is what they should be doing. They should be trying to identify plots, bomb plots, things like that before they happen and interfering. In fact, talking to an FBI guy while filming the movie about this exact scenario that I'm describing, the way the FBI perceives it is basically you don't want to be constantly playing goal line defense. In other words, by the time the bomb is made and being planted, it's like pretty much too late to stop it. So they want to do things that stop the plot at the 50-yard line or the 30-yard line or the 10-yard line, you know, near your end zone. So they get involved very early. They seed people into the groups. They connect them with, you know, people who can help them out, who turn out to be FBI agents, who give them bombs to go test in the desert or give them fake bombs to go plant, and then they bust them. You know, kind of like the January 6th bomber, kind of like that. Here's what AG Pam Bondi said about it. After an intense investigation, the Department of Justice, working with our FBI, prevented what would have been a massive and horrific terror attack. in the Central District of California. The Turtle Island Liberation Front, a far-left, pro-Palestine, anti-government, and anti-capitalist group, was preparing to conduct a series of bombings against multiple targets in California beginning on New Year's Eve. The group also planned to target ICE agents and vehicles. This was an incredible effort by our U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI to ensure Americans can live in peace. We continue to pursue these terror groups and bring them to justice. Again, I would just ask, why is it that the only people being arrested for this stuff are the people actively involved in the physical attacks? Why in Texas, when an Antifa group attacks an ICE facility and shoots agents with a established multi-stage military ambush, are only the people actually on the ground there that day arrested? How are you not using these arrests to arrest or at least identify and dismantle the wider networks? I don't understand. And again, they keep wanting to play this up as if they're a anti-Palestinian group, but obviously that was just one facet of their general anti-American ideology. Turtle Island, again, is a reference to what America was called before Europeans got here. It's an anti-colonialist group, a.k.a. just communist agitators. As Max Blumenthal notes, it looks like another terror plot manufactured by the FBI, which relied on well-paid confidential human informants to justify repression of leftist protest groups. The targets were here operated a recently created IG account with less than 1,000 followers. So this is from the filing. It says the CHS, that is the Confidential Human Service, is cooperating with law enforcement and is a validated and vetted source. The CHS has been a reliable source of information since in or around August 2021. The CHS is cooperating for financial compensation. The CDS does not have any criminal history. The CHS provided past reliable reporting in other cases and has provided reliable reporting in this case. So it sounds like there is a professional human source that had been working with the FBI for the last 4 years involved in this. Again, Max Blumenthal is saying, you know, they're using this as an excuse to bust up leftist protest networks. I'd say, yeah, good. I'd say, okay, good. When those quote-unquote protest networks want to plant bombs in American cities, yeah, I think that's actually exactly what the FBI is supposed to do. Ken Silva, again, noting the case files here. He says, one of the defendants allegedly provided an FBI informant with an eight-page document describing the bomb plot in this case. The informant has been working with the Bureau since 2021, no criminal record, meaning the person is a paid operative. And they say that in November 2025, Carroll, a member of the Turtle Island Liberation Front, provided a confidential human source with an eight-page handwritten document titled Operation Midnight Sun that described this bombing plot. One of the defendants, that's the same one here, in response to FBI Director Kash Patel celebrating this. They say an undercover FBI employee was also included, so this would be in addition to the confidential human source. The co-conspirators met on December 7th to further discuss the bombing plot and their intent to conduct future attacks on federal officials. Based on information from the CHS and FBI personnel, including an undercover FBI employee, UCE, who was present at the meeting, they know that on the early morning of December 7th, 2025, the CHS and UCE met with Carol Page in a mail to the group known as Nomad, later identified as Dante Garfield or Gaffield. Carol stated she had the plan and handed Garfield four sheets of paper with writing on the front and back of each page, which Gaffield said and the UCE read. The UCE later told law enforcement that the paper contained detailed instructions on how to construct a black powder pipe bomb. Okay, so that's what we got. Now, again, where this is maybe a tad bit suspicious, or at least, you know, related to other things we've seen in the past, is if we go to, I believe we go to clip number two here. It's the same, you know, video that we saw earlier, clip number two. But for now, take a look at the African-American FBI agent who's standing there, because he has cropped up in other bombing plots that we've seen before. Let's go to clip number two here.
So, as I mentioned in my talking points,
so this guy.
On December 12th, a group of individuals, again, members of this anti-government group, traveled out to the desert to test their explosive devices. They had precursor chemicals there, and they were going to...
we've seen this, but that guy at the podium giving that message, people recognized him. Ken Silva in particular recognized him. He was actually on with Brandon Morello on American Journal earlier this morning. But he noticed that he's the same FBI official who was giving a press conference about a bomb plot to bomb a fertility clinic in Florida. The suspicious thing about this, from May of this year, May 2025, headlineusa.com, FBI reportedly seen near suspected fertility clinic bomber's home before the attack. Guy Edward Barkus of 29 Palms, California, has been identified by the FBI as the suspect in an apparent car bombing Saturday that damaged the clinic in an upscale city of Palm Springs in the desert east of Los Angeles. It killed Barkus in the process. Most of the media has been focused on Barkus's anti-natalist views, which hold that people should not continue to procreate, authorities said. You would think this type of thing would be included in the statistics of leftist domestic terror, but it's not. At least one reporter has raised questions about whether the alleged bomber was on the FBI's radar beforehand. At the FBI press conference on Sunday, a reporter from the area's local news channel 3 asked about the matter. The press conference was shut down immediately after she asked her question. And we actually have that footage. We can go to that clip number 4 here. This is all the way back in May of 2025. Same agent that we just saw present the information about the Turtle Island case was there in Florida, shutting down the press conference after being asked about why FBI agents were seen a day before this bombing took place. Let's watch.
Combing through right now is kind of what led us to that nihilist belief.
Breaking news channel 3. We had a reporter on scene at the 29 Palms area yesterday, and community members were telling her that there was an FBI presence there in the days leading up to that. Can you confirm that?
I cannot.
Okay, folks, that concludes this press conference.
Okay, we're done, folks. No more questions. Okay, sorry, you asked the question about the thing you're not supposed to know about. We're done here. Thanks. And my mistake, I keep saying Florida. It's California, Palm Springs. So that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Okay, so here's a guy who's in the FBI. Obviously, he's a part of whatever squad in California deals with potential bomb threats. Again, nothing particularly suspicious about this, except that in the case of the Palm Springs bombing, the bomb went off. The bomb went off. So again, from the story from Ken Silva, we had a reporter on the scene at 29 Palms area yesterday, and community members were telling her that there was an FBI presence there in the days leading up to the attack. Can you confirm that? I cannot, responded Akil Davis. I guess that's the guy's name, the assistant director in charge of the FBI's Los Angeles office. Another FBI official immediately piped in, ending the conference just as Davis was about to take another question. The FBI insists that Barkus was not on its radar. Authorities were executing a search warrant Sunday in 29 Palms, a city of 28,000 residents, around 50 miles northwest of Palm Springs. As part of the investigation, the bomb gutted the American Reproductive Center Fertility Clinic and shattered the windows of nearby buildings along a palm tree-lined street. Witnesses describe a loud boom followed by a chaotic scene with people screaming in terror as glass strewn along the sidewalk and street. So this is what happens when the FBI maybe doesn't have the control that it should over its confidential human sources, its false flag PSYOP terrorist attacks. Sometimes they go wrong. Sometimes they go rogue. Sometimes the people that you're entrapping realize they're being entrapped and decide to just go with it anyway. Maybe, you know, they hand him the bomb and the guy knows enough about bombing to know that it was a fake bomb after all and made a real one instead. It's not a great look if the FBI repeatedly busts people in the same way where they pretend to go along with the bomb plot only to catch them in the act at the last minute. If sometimes it goes wrong, if sometimes you have bombings that take out fertility clinics and people in the neighborhood said, hey, you know, the FBI was hanging around that house all day yesterday. So it sounds like maybe the FBI, you know, utterly failed in this regard. Maybe that's why they moved up the arrest from being, you know, like actually during the event to the testing process in the desert. Luckily, nobody was killed in this, but obviously easily could have. The bombing injured 4 other people, although Davis said the embryos at the facility were saved. I guess this is the convenience of being the FBI. If you succeed, then you get all of the kudos of busting a terror plot. And if you fail, which actually means you just participated in a terror plot, and you get to cover it up for national security and, you know, sources and methods, claims that mean you don't have to tell anybody what you're actually doing. It's very convenient for them. You have to wonder how many other terrorist attacks that have occurred recently have been involved with the FBI beforehand. If the FBI uses this MO of having people inside these groups, sometimes for years on end, feeding them information, how many times have those people been allowed to carry out attacks with the full knowledge of the FBI who refused to do anything to stop it? I have to wonder. And when you look at something like the January 6th pipe bomb, you see an exact pattern of behavior with the FBI where this has happened before, where they are involved with somebody that they're trying to trick into thinking they're bombing something, and it turns out they just go bomb the place. They just go bomb the thing. And then the FBI has to scramble to cover up their own awareness and participation in this. It all points to the inordinate corruption and incompetence in our federal agencies. Doesn't make me feel any safer, that's for damn sure. We do have some more information, kind of, about the Brown shooter. The Providence Police Department on Tuesday released a new image of the suspect gunman wanted for killing two and injuring nine others in a mass shooting at Brown University on Saturday. The image shows a person walking down the street with black pants, a dark two-toned jacket, a face mask, a beanie, and a bag. This comes after authorities released additional information and photos of the suspect on Monday. The FBI has offered a reward of up to $50,000 for information that leads to the identification, arrest, and conviction of the suspect. Again, we have very little information about this. It is truly bizarre to see headlines like, after mess-ups, they are starting the investigation over from scratch. What are you inviting the guy back? Hey, come kill more people and we'll start over. We'll see if we can get you this time. It is insane. And, of course, the most insane part is that all of these universities are absolutely covered in cameras. There's absolutely no way that this is the only footage that we have of this guy. That is a lie. And by the way, I mentioned it yesterday, but it hadn't been confirmed. It was merely rumors. Now it more or less has been confirmed. The Brown mass shooter reportedly yelled Allahu Akbar before attacking. Several media outlets quoted students and other witnesses saying that the shooter yelled Allahu Akbar before opening fire in the building. Now, as a community note to this, maybe some people are saying he might have yelled something else. We did have the official report saying he yelled something. They just didn't say what that thing was. Yeah, you have witness interviews saying it was Allahu Akbar, which seems to align with rumors. Now, I'm not actually going to say this guy's name because I don't know how confirmed this is. But essentially, people have been monitoring Brown University, and they found that they have taken down a page that was celebrating a particular first-year Muslim student. Now, I don't know if this means anything. I don't know if this was just a coincidence, but basically they have these pages that are student spotlights, and they have a student spotlight for a particular Muslim freshman that apparently, without explanation, was deleted from their website yesterday. So people monitoring the website noticed that and are pointing to that saying, hey, maybe this is who they're looking for, which would mean, and I'm not showing the name, we get in trouble for this, crew. This is one thing that I'm not going to play games with. It's a mass shooting, and I will not be publishing anybody's name without a mugshot to go along with it. But you can look it up for yourself if you want to find out whose name they removed. And it would hint that not only is the idea this was a Muslim attacker, you know, more likely confirmed, but it would also hint that the people in charge know the guy's name and are withholding it for some reason. Maybe they want to scrub his social media before they announce this person. Could that have something to do with it? I think so. We'll be right back.
My Pillow alone, just My Pillow, not counting me, it cost them over $200 million directly related to Arctic Frost, everybody. What they've done to my company, tried to just wipe them off the face of the earth because I'm out there going, we need to secure our elections. We need to secure our election. We need to get rid of the machines. We need to go to paper ballots.
You were literally terrorized and targeted, and it's in the documents.
And that thing goes so deep. It's funny, Alex. Things go so far, and then they tend to get stopped. But you guys, just know, I am never stopping. I will never stop. My number one thing is we need to secure our election platform.
Let's talk about this. People supporting what you're doing and getting the highest quality, you name it, great products. almost all of it made in America. Your great Giza sheets have that special cotton everybody knows comes from Egypt, but you're amazing. Right. I've got some on my king bed. Talk about the incredible products you've got at MyPillow.com/Alex. And again, I want to be clear. We are only here still hanging on, but now people support at thealexjonesstore.com or at mypillow.com/Alex is absolutely critical. This is now literally up to you every month whether we're going to stay in this fight. We're both workaholics. We love people. We love telling the truth. You know, these corrupt people, you know, think we're schmucks because we're not corrupt. No, we know how to be corrupt if we wanted to, dumbasses. But we like being good people. That's what builds a society.
We're the tip of the spear. This is it. We only get one shot at this. And like I said, about 2 years ago, they said, Mike, would you, if you could turn back time here and go back, and if you wanted to spoke out about the election, wouldn't stand your ground. You know, look what they've destroyed, tried to destroy you. I said, I would never change a thing knowing what I know and knowing what this is critical. And that's where we're at. And it's because of all of you, because you buy our products. And that's why we're putting right now on sale our five flagship products. We have five flagship products, our biggest products of all time. For you go to mypillow.com/Alex, and you guys are going to see we've got the Giza Dream Sheets. If you put that thing up there, these are all for Christmas presents. You guys, you can get the best Christmas presents ever. The Giza Dream Sheets, the towels, the slippers. On the MyPillow Premiums, we've sold 85 million MyPillows because they work. You save over 50% on those. And then the mattress toppers made in the USA, $149.98, as low as that, depending on the size. But we got in the premium My Towels that actually work. You save 50% there, $39.98. And here's one of my favorites, the My Slippers. Best slippers in history. They're normally $149.98, $39.98. And once they're gone, they're gone. We can't get those back. They're made with impact gel, made out of soybeans. And so you walk on them and it's like walking on a cloud. It's absolutely awesome. This patented gel that's in there. And then you have the Giza Dream Sheets. It's my favorite product. It's our president's favorite product. And not as low as $29.98. And I'm going to show you one more. You guys go there. And you're getting five of these Bible pillows. These are very dear to me. They've got stories on the back. You get basically five Christmas gifts for $29.98 for all five. You got the baby Jesus, Noah's Ark, Daniel in the Lion's Den, but you get all five of them. So you get five individual gifts for under $6 a piece. Free shipping, promo code Alex on your entire order. No matter what you are, this is an exclusive free shipping on your entire order. So go to mypillow.com/Alex, and it's a win-win-win. You guys are supporting my employee-owned company. You're getting the best products at the best prices in history. You're supporting this great, Alex's great show. I'll tell you, Alex, I can't be prouder more proud than anyone that support your show and what you put out and help save this country more than anyone, and I mean that.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
This is the War Room. Just listening to my favorite rendition of O Holy Night. Christmas is coming up fast, folks. You still have time, depending on where you live. I know yesterday was the cutoff for getting your deliveries anywhere in time for Christmas, but we, of course, ship quickly to the continental United States, and you still have time to get your Christmas gifts at thealexjonesstore.com. Massive discounts across the board, of course. Incredible products, Ultra Methylene Blue. People go crazy over this stuff. Of course, we have the new Ultra DNA Revival. That's like the badass little brother of DNA Force Plus, one of the most popular products ever at the InfoWars at InfoWarsStore.com. Well, the AlexJonesStore.com now has Ultra DNA Revival, helps repair some of the damage to your DNA that simply wears out over time. It's not something that it's not something that anybody doesn't need. You know what I mean? It's like literally everybody needs this, unless you have found the fountain of youth and are somehow immune to the ravages of time. Yeah, you need these products, okay? If you're not immortal, if you're not a demigod, you need the AlexJonesStore.com. We all age. We all go through, you know, times of ill health, but the AlexJonesStore.com can keep you at tip-top shape and help you recover in those dips. The AlexJonesStore.com, creatine, just incredible stuff. Massive sales, and of course, order quickly if you want to get it by Christmas or New Year's, so these supplements can help you achieve your goals and fulfill your resolutions in 2026. With that, I want to talk about this Lost Generation article. Before I do that, last segment we were talking about all of the terrorist attacks from over the weekend. We don't have a lot of new information about the attack in Australia, although what we do have is absurd. In fact, it's now been revealed that the man who ran up and disarmed one of the gunmen, incredibly, unimaginably brave act, ran up to this guy who had a shotgun, ripped the shotgun out of his hands. Then that guy, the hero who disarmed the shooter, was then shot by police, who apparently didn't show up for 20 minutes. There's footage of the police hiding behind cars while the shooting continues. They hide for 20 minutes. They finally show up, and a female officer shoots the one guy who's heroically fighting back. In fact, that's not true. There were other people who were heroically fighting back. It wasn't caught on video, so didn't quite get that the visual of it, but very brave people in Australia trying to prevent the massacre as it unfolded with no help from the police. So that's, I mean, that is your life under globalism. It's give us your guns, we'll take care of you, but also the police aren't obligated to intervene in a violent situation. We'll wait till it all sort of peters out. And we might shoot you in the process. Whoops. Sorry. Sorry about that, folks. It is absolutely pathetic. Disarming the populace. Police cowering behind vehicles while citizens engage the shooters. And then when the police finally decide to get involved, they end up shooting the guy who was helping. And there's more information coming out about who this guy was. This guy apparently is an immigrant. I've heard he's possibly a Maronite Christian from Lebanon. But again, you can see sort of the, not to knock him, I mean the incredible bravery, but also the mercy. The guy interrupts a mass shooting, rips a shotgun out of the shooter's hand, trains the shotgun on the man, doesn't pull the trigger. I get it. I mean, in that instance, God only knows what's going through his mind. I can't even imagine being in that position, so I'm not criticizing or anything. I'm just saying it would have been nice for the shooting to end right there in spectacular fashion. Wouldn't it have been? And that sort of goes into the theme that we're going to talk about with Compact Magazine and just getting over, consciously training yourself to get over the imposed cowardice of the modern world. We'll get to that in just a second. But I know Alex was going off about, people blaming the shooting in Bondi Beach on Israel. And I agree. And I was even talking about this yesterday and I posted it and people were posting Alex's clip under mine going, maybe you should listen to Alex. He knows what he's talking about. And I was going, I'm saying the same thing as him. I'm not trying to downplay the threat of radical Islam and Islamic terror. It's absolutely real. And I'm not allying with those people and I've never wanted to. And that's always been my position. And I've gotten in arguments about this over the weekend. I went on a space with Soleiman whatever because he was trying to claim that InfoWars is Zionist because of some reason or another, because we are contributing to the Zionist paradigm, a Zionist narrative about Islam taking over. And it's like, no, dude, I don't want to be taken over by Islam. What are you talking about? It's as absurd as saying, supporting Israel is an anti-Muslim thing. It's just, that's not how this works. a lot of people have this dichotomous view where it's like your whole worth as a person is defined by your position on Israel. Soleimani himself said to me after Charlie Kirk's assassination, why are you sad about Charlie? He was a Zionist. As if that is my, you know, entire metric of whether somebody is worthy of life is, are they on my team when it comes to Israel's territorial expansion? Like, I could not care less about that when it comes to Charlie Kirk. It was the thing I disagreed with him most about. Charlie Kirk was firmly on my team. However the teams break out, Charlie Kirk was me. He was a white, Protestant, Christian, American man. That's my team, bro. I don't care what he thought about Zionism. I genuinely don't. But people out there have this idea that if you don't want Islam taking over, you're pro-Zionist. I know Alex has covered this enough, so I don't need to get into it. But I will say that I think it's perfectly reasonable to at least suspect Israel as having been participating in these types of things before. I said on X yesterday, if Miss Krabappel, if Edna Krabappel from The Simpsons finds a thumbtack in her seat, she blames Bart Simpson. Now, that might not be entirely fair to Bart, but we also don't feel that bad for him either, right? So go, someone did a prank on the teacher and they blamed Bart. Well, Bart, why would that be? Why is that, Bart? Oh, a mass terror attack. It's out of nowhere, a psychological nuclear bomb on the people of Australia immediately being transformed into anti-Semitism law. Not exactly out of the Israeli wheelhouse, let's just say. Now, to then just assert that anything Muslims do is therefore a false flag attack by Mossad is absurd. Obviously, I'm not making that claim, and I think people that do are disingenuous and hurting their own cause. Both of these things. They are both disingenuous because they don't actually have proof for what they're claiming, and yet they are asserting it as if they do. But also, if your cause is true, if your cause is based on facts, then purporting non-facts as facts is only damaging your cause. Like, if you don't need to lie, why are you lying? You see what I mean? If your cause is totally legitimate and has all this evidence to it, then you don't need to make up other evidence that you don't actually have. So, all of that is to say, there was a supposedly Pakistani, now people are saying Indian, foreign migrant to Australia, and his son carried out this attack. And that would not be, if this was a false flag attack, which I don't know if it is, but if it was, it would look very similar to another false flag attempted to be carried out by Israel on Mexico in 2001. This is from Monitor X 99800 on X. They say, in 2001, Mossad agents posing as Pakistani nationals entered Mexican parliament in a failed attempt to commit a massacre. The media buried the story and Israel got them back. So on October 10th, 2001, two Israelis, one of them a dual citizen of Mexico, were arrested after reportedly acting in a strange manner and failing to properly identify themselves when requested. They were later found to be carrying false Pakistani passports, firearms, as well as explosives, and identified as former members of the Israeli Special Forces. These men were then released after mediation from Israeli authorities. Apparently in 2001, right, following the September 11th attacks, Israelis were caught with explosives and guns, dressed up as Pakistanis, trying to carry out a mass casualty event in parliament in Mexico. So now that there's a mass casualty event in Australia with Pakistani nationals carrying out this attack, just in time and aligned with the wider push for global anti-Semitism, superstructures, I'm not going to blame you for being suspicious. That's how I feel about it. Now, moving on. Although we could delve more into this, because it is taking the exact trajectory that we always said it would. All the way back to the Piers Morgan interview with Alex Jones, when Alex is saying you can't ban the iron bar, Piers. My argument has always been, if you take their argument to the logical conclusion, the obvious thing to ban is the thoughts that compel violence, right? Okay, you ban guns. Now people are committing crimes with knives. You ban knives. Ooh, they're going to stop being violent. Are they going to stop feeling anger? They'll start using their fists. Are you going to ban fists? Are you going to ban the human body? You can't do that. So what do? You ban the anger that inspires the violence. Or you ban the information that inspires the anger that inspires the violence. That's what you have to do if your ultimate goal is eliminating violence as a concept in your society, which is an asinine and unachievable goal. But that's what they're pursuing with gun control laws. And so if banning the tools doesn't work, you have to ban the motivation to use the tools. And so now that's literally what Australia is saying. They're saying we already banned guns. Now we have to ban anti-Semitism, which is just the first. We're not even really the first in Australia, but really I should say it's just the latest category of thought to be banned because it could inspire violence. The truth often does inspire violence. The truth often makes people angry, makes them want to do violent things. That's not an excuse to censor the truth, but that's what they're doing. But we'll move on. But that is what they're doing. Pray for Australia. I guess we go to one of these videos, but I want to get into this because I did some research. I did some backup research here to try to identify how the anti-white industrial complex came to be. Now, this is another example of an almost daily occurrence here, quotidian phenomenon we have to deal with, where bombshell news stories hit the headlines, dominate the conversation on X and elsewhere, and yet it's stuff that everybody should know by now. It's stuff that's been reported on ad nauseum for a decade. Now, I'm glad this article was written. It is a very good article. It's from Compact Magazine, The Lost Generation. It makes the argument about the discrimination against white people in a very effective and altruistic and empathetic way. It actually tells the story of several young men entering the workforce in the 2010s and the just utter desperation and discrimination that they faced as a consequence, which is good. You know, I guess this is what we need. And actually, this is sort of our position at InfoWars and always has been. We can give you the data. People don't react to data. They react to narratives. They react to emotion. Now, you can take this in the globalist way and look at it cynically and go, we just need to manipulate people's emotion, then they'll do what we want. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if I just give you stats and go, 39% of this industry was white people and now it's 24%. Doesn't do a lot to raise your hackles, right? But if I tell you a story about one of those 29% and the fact that he, you know, loses his house because he gets fired because somebody wants to boost the ESG score and then his wife leaves him. And like, if you actually tell the story of misery that's represented by those stats, the stats actually mean something. They actually inform people and their thoughts and how they want to move forward in life. So I guess it's good that this article came out and is so well written and is so compelling and is so emotionally centered with a lot of facts within it. But it is a little bit frustrating when, like, there was never a time where this wasn't ridiculous. Just like transgenderism, just like the war in Ukraine, just like everything we deal with, there was never a time when this discrimination against white people was reasonable, understandable, justifiable, and it's gone off the rails since then. No. It was ridiculous from the beginning. Everybody should have recognized it was ridiculous from the beginning. And everybody should have stood up against this powerfully, strongly, in whatever way that they can. Legally, just internally in your own company. But we didn't for some reason. The American people didn't for some reason. InfoWars, we did. No, we got it. We understood it. We were shouting from the rooftops before 99% of people even knew this was coming. But for the vast majority of Americans, I don't get it. I don't. Same thing with transgenderism. It's just like, how did anybody think this was normal? At what point did somebody say, hey, I know my daughter thinks she's a boy, let's give her a mastectomy? Who was the first person to not act with, you know, insane incredulity in response to that? Who was the first person to go, hey, you know, maybe we should mutilate our daughter because she's mentally ill? That's a good idea. Somebody at some point decided that was a normal thing to believe, and then everybody else just went along with it. I don't get it. Do you need somebody else to tell you that this is absurd? It's the white guilt thing, obviously, is mostly what it is. And it's also the effectiveness of the psychological pressure points being activated here. Because if you were one of these young men who was discriminated against, you understood that your failure to get a job, your failure to establish yourself, was all but guaranteed if you pushed back. That your only hope was in either meekly going along with this, trying to see if you could skirt under the radar, or actively becoming a like prominent perpetrator of this crime. Your only hope was to like pretend to be gay and act like you were also a flagrant leftist idiot who wanted to tear down your own people. Then maybe you could, you know, be granted a spot at the table. But that speaking up was the last thing you should do because of the social pressures that were wielded. And that's what I want to talk about here, is those pressures, the social pressures, how they were wielded, how we can be informed by this to not fall for it again. Now, again, I'm not saying this in retrospect. I'm saying this in condemnation. I'm saying this to everybody that fell for this. What is wrong with you? I hope you've learned your lesson. This was always obvious from the beginning. And it's so unbelievable that anybody ever fell for this. There's like, oh, we're going to discriminate against white people. And white people went, okay. Why? Why did you say okay to that? Why did you believe their justification? Let me get into the article. Let me actually read to you what it says and some of the more astonishing, you know, insights in this. But essentially, the argument that it's making is that the people to blame for the fact that white people don't exist in all these industries anymore are the older white Gen X boomers. Because they're the ones that sold out their own sons. They're the ones that sold out their own grandsons. They're the ones that kept their cushy jobs and pulled the ladder up behind them to make it impossible for anybody like them to get where they are. See, they were indoctrinated and inculcated into this anti-white mindset over their entire lives. We're talking about boomers here, right? The baby boomer, the people born right after World War II, the people whose entire lives have been dominated by the post-World War II propaganda environment. He says, in 2011, the year I moved to Los Angeles, white men were 48% of lower-level TV writers. By 2024, they accounted for just 11.9%. Deliberate, on purpose, like this doesn't just happen, okay? Now, what he says is that in retrospect, 2014 was the hinge, the year DEI became institutionalized across American life. Now, why would that be? What happened in 2014? That's what I wanted to look into. Now, this was basically just from this guy's personal observation. He talks about how ham-fisted it was, the way that DEI was being implemented. But it didn't matter how ham-fisted it was because nobody did anything about it. Like, this is the bizarre thing. He's like shocked that in hiring meetings, they openly say don't hire white people. It's like, why are you shocked by this? First of all, they are not shy about how they genuinely hate white people, want to, disempower them, want to disenfranchise them. Like, you should not be surprised by this. And also, why wouldn't they? They're sitting in a room full of white guys. They go, we're not going to hire any more white guys. And all the white guy goes, oh, okay. yeah, why are you shocked that they're so open and blatant? You're all pussies. Like, do you not understand that? The correct response at the time, when somebody in this blatant and outrageous way is just like, we're going to try to diversify. That means no white people and no men, okay? The correct response would be, excuse me, what the hell did you just say? Are you trying to get the FCC to kick our door down or whatever? Are you trying to get us in trouble with the federal government openly discriminating? You are fired. Actually, you're fired. Now, how dare you say such an outrageous thing? I cannot imagine what made you think that would be an appropriate sentiment to express. Get the hell out of our office immediately. Is that not exactly what the response would be for literally any other group? I mean, my God. Should I just rewrite this article and write the word Jews? Will that inform people on what exactly we're talking about here? Will it break through the propaganda firewall around your brain that makes you understand the open, unacceptable discrimination at play here and how you don't have to stand for it? This is like my ultimate goal. How do I get people to get over that? How do I compel people to be confident enough in their own beliefs to simply assert the truth and prevent the lies from taking over? How do I convince you to feel exactly the same when you hear the word Jew, as you hear the word white, as you hear the word black, as you hear the word Indian? None of it matters in terms of the value of the thing being described. What matters is understanding that these racial designations matter to the people involved. And you don't have to be silent about it. You don't have to sit there and let people abuse you because of your race. You don't have to let them replace everybody like you because you get a pat on the head. You are literally selling out your own children to people who despise you. And you think that makes you a good person. What the hell is wrong with you? And what is this psychological imperative where if I gave an article to a normie that says white people are being discriminated against, they don't care. If I give them the same article with any other designation, they think it's the worst thing in the world. How do we get over that imposed discrepancy, that imposed cognitive dissonance that is like the prison door on the jail cell of the New World Order? We can open it at any point. Everybody has a key. Nobody has the ability to check their pockets and pull it out. It's wild how simple it is to defeat all of this.
Ladies and gentlemen, Nitric Boost, the all-time fan favorite, is now back in stock at InfoWarsStore.com.
You've looked at our formula. You like it?
I did, and I do, yes. Well, nitric oxide is a key. It's made by our own bodies again. It's made by L-citrulline and L-arginine, the amino acids.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Judy Mikovits, without me even knowing she'd gotten it and used it, came on years ago and said this was the best spike protein detoxer she'd found.
So you want to boost your own body's ability. The nitric oxide relaxes the endothelium, the vasculature. It relaxes the vein. So I use the two, your InfoWars. I keep that on my shelf. And I feed myself the Cardio Miracle, which is just straight food. It's a different formulation than that one. And the two together are a 1-2 punch. So you get in your food the ability to make what you need and no more.
It is already a nationwide best-selling bodybuilding product for over 20 years. Bodybuilders take it as it helps grow muscles and better workouts and things. So for those of you that love Nitric Boost, it's back in stock right now at InfoWarsStore.com. And for those that haven't tried Nitric Boost, you are really missing out. Secure your Nitric Boost right now at InfoWarsStore.com. We're battling in the courts. We're still here. A year after the Onion said they bought us, We might actually hold on and win. But regardless, the shopping cart's there, the shipments are going out, and you will get your product. But if you don't order it and support us, we'll be off the air. So please take action now at InfoWarsStore.com and experience Nitric Boost for yourself. It's good for men and women. Get your Nitric Boost now, right now, exclusively at InfoWarsStore.com. And thanks for being the reason, one way or another, we'll always be on the air. InfoWarsStore.com, Nitric Boost, back in stock.
Welcome back, folks. We're dreaming of a white Christmas here at InfoWars. I'm going to continue to dig into this article that has absolutely dominated the conversation over the last few days from Compact Magazine. But let me give you the history first. So in this, he identifies 2014 as a pivotal year where things changed. He says, in retrospect, 2014 was the hinge, the year DEI became institutionalized across American life. And here's why. From trellis.net, 2014, the year sustainable investment went mainstream. See, in this article from Compact, they talk about the consequences of this. They talk about what it's like to be subject to the discrimination. And yet the whole thing treats the phenomenon as just that, a phenomenon, as a, you know, mental disease that swept through the population like a pandemic. No, this was deliberate. This was compelled from on high. This was done on purpose. And you can identify the methods that this was employed through this article, because in this article, this person describes his attempt to break into Hollywood and a journalist trying to get hired and academia. So you have academia, entertainment, and journalism. It's not a coincidence that these three industries were some of the first and most extreme going headlong into anti-white discrimination, anti-male, anti-Christian discrimination, which is in fact what ESG is, just a different name for it. Because it was about shaping the mindset around what they were doing. Because they couldn't just fire a bunch of white guys without seeding the media landscape with a narrative that portrayed it as a good thing, that made people scared to question what was going on. They targeted newsrooms and entertainment circles first, and academia, because it shapes the minds of people. It was on purpose. It was by design. Just like the censorship, this all comes out of the banks. It comes from the banks and their organizing and managerial manifestations like the World Economic Forum. So in 2014 was the year that they codified ESG and DEI scores and started pushing it in a real way at Davos, the World Economic Forum meeting, as well as BlackRock and all the others, started embedding this into their investments, meaning that it wasn't even a choice for industries whether or not to discriminate against white people. They were financially obligated to do so because with complete, you know, arbitrary demands, BlackRock simply asserted that from now on, you were a better investment if you were more diverse. Absolutely, completely unrelated to the profit motive of corporations. The whole point of capitalism, what it's supposed to be designed around, is you offer something people want, they pay you for it, everybody goes home happy. If you aren't doing it well, if you aren't prioritizing the right things, you're going to lose money, you're going to go out of business. So you're incentivized naturally to choose the best people. Here comes BlackRock to say, actually, we think you should choose non-white people, even if they're worse for the job, and then we'll grade you higher as an investment risk. It's one of these things that it's like, how did anybody go along with this ever? It's actually literally against the law, which I don't even agree with the law, but Ford versus Dodge settled this. You are not allowed to make decisions like this on the basis of your own personal proclivity. You have to be able to justify it through profit. So then these big corporations understand that the world's largest investment companies are grading their performance, determining who that gets money and who doesn't, off of their willingness to engage in DEI ESG practices. So they engage in them because otherwise they don't get the investments, their stock market price plummets, other people get out, it becomes a feedback loop, their company goes down. They were compelled to do this by BlackRock, Larry Fink, and the World Economic Forum. I'll lay it out on the other side.
Challenging all of you to support the broadcast, keep us on air while you get great products, and it's a win-win. We need funds, we are in the red, and we've got to be able to continue our legal battles. We've got to be able to continue to buy new product going in the future. We've got to continue with the funding to build the Alex Jones backup network in case they're able to shut us down. I cannot do it without you, so now is the time to go to thealexjonesstore.com and do your final Christmas shopping there. Anywhere in the United States, if you order by Friday, you will get it before Christmas. So get your orders in now. Do your Christmas shopping with us, but really give yourself the gift of health with our creatine gummies, the highest quality type of creatine, 5 milligrams, that's a daily serving per gummy, huge container of them, such a great deal. This is the best creatine out there. There's so many other great products and a whole bunch of other sales and deals. You can become a subscriber right now on any product, cancel any time, and it reorders every month and get 50% off on all future orders. The widest selection of t-shirts, hoodies, ball caps, sweaters, many of them limited edition at thealexjonesstore.com.
You're listening to The War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now at X.com.
Welcome back, folks. Very coincidental thing just happened. I guess to keep it vague, I found out that I'm family friends with the person that wrote this article. And I've got some anonymous feedback for you from some people with some thoughts about what's going on, some elaboration on it. And I am going to continue to get through some of the more insane parts of this story. But again, just getting to why this happened. Why, you know, it's weird that we have to talk about this because we have been talking about it for years and everybody's acting like this is the first article to broach this, but like this has been a thing forever and we've been talking about it forever. It's not confusing. I mean, there's this article from 2 years ago after and they changed the headline. The original headline was after Black Lives Matter, corporate America promised to hire more people of color. It did. And then it's this celebration of the fact that since the death of George Floyd, 94% of executive hires in American corporations were non-white males. Only 6% were white. I guess it's not even white males. I guess it's literally just white. So 60% of the population, 6% of the hires. 60% of the population, 6% of the executive hires. On purpose, by design, because corporations told everybody, we are from now on discriminating on the basis of race. And everybody said, okay, for some reason, totally crazy. So it's not even like this, any of this is new. We know that this has been a well-advertised, well-established practice, purported, like promoted and supported and encouraged by Larry Fink and Bill Gates and everybody who talks about this stuff. Like, why we're acting like this was an unexpected outcome. What else would you expect? What other outcome could there possibly be? Like, I get that it's good that we have an article that really lays out exactly how devastating it is to be affected by this, but this has just been going on. Again, it doesn't make sense. It's not a good thing, but that's my real question. It's not like, oh my gosh, this is so bad. How do we like get back from this? Is like, what did you think was going on for the last 5 years? What did you think the outcome of the deliberate discrimination could have possibly been? This is the original headline. Corporate America promised to hire a lot more people of color. It actually did. The year after Black Lives Matter protests, the S&P 100 added more than 300,000 jobs 94% went to non-whites. Yeah, Apple, Walmart, Wells Fargo, you know, all of these massive corporations that are currently spending tens of billions of dollars outsourcing our jobs to India. Probably part of that, you know, people of color hiring spree that happened. You know, don't hire white guys, hire the Indian guys. Oh, look, it turns out they sold out your entire company to their home nation. Gee, who would have thought? Who would have ever expected such an event? Crazy. Okay, so we've known this forever. This has been the case forever. Not that complicated. Again, I just want to say, like, why this ever became a thing is almost impossible to comprehend in the same way that it's possible for me to comprehend why transgenderism became a thing. Very similar things here. A lot of similarities here on how they pulled this off and how they got people to go along with this. In your own life, would you ever, like, if you saved up, you worked every day, you put $100 a week away in a tin can, and finally you have $10,000, your precious money, your life energy, right, in physical form. You have that $10,000. If you invest it poorly, it goes away and all that work goes to nothing. If you invest it well, you can live off that money. It can provide dividends for a long time. Are you going to take the racial makeup of the board into account? Maybe if you're a racist, but like, is that what you're concerned about? Or are you going to look at, okay, these people sell products. They're making a product that people like. They're going to get a lot of customers. I'll go with them. This company has a long track record of steady growth. I'll go with them. It is an act of insanity to come in and say, I know, I'll invest my money because this boardroom has the highest percentage of black women. In fact, all of my investments forever will be almost entirely dictated on the percentage of black women in the boardroom. You would go broke. It's an absurd way to judge investments. That's the way BlackRock decided they were going to invest. The board of BlackRock, who is, I remind you, entirely composed of Jewish men, decided to use their inordinate financial power to force every corporation in the country to suddenly judge their own profitability on the basis of whether or not they had a lot of white people. It is so crazy. And I've talked to bankers about this. And I've asked bankers, like, you know, this was like years ago before ESG was well known to everybody. And I asked them, like, so do you know about this, like, ESG thing? They're like, oh, yeah, yeah. It's like a new metric that BlackRock has. And I'm like, yeah, that doesn't really make sense, does it? And they're like, well, kind of not. But, you know, they want to make it more diverse. It's just like, okay, what? So now, like, your job is to manage people's money, and you're going to put your clients' money in companies based on their diversity? You're going to lose all your – why is anybody going along with this? But they have to, because BlackRock controls the world. They have trillions of dollars in investment. They manage all the retirement funds. If they say that ESG score is the new metric that we're grading by, companies fall in line. They have to, or they don't get investment, and they go under. And if a CEO or a board member tries to resist it, the investors get cold feet, want that person out to bring in somebody who will serve the interests of BlackRock. And this is sort of proven by the fact that all of this came about in 2014, exactly when all of these institutions like the World Economic Forum, BlackRock itself, codified this into official policy. 2014, Trellis.net. The year sustainable investment went mainstream. Sustainable, responsible, and, quote, impact investing assets have soared 76% in the last 2 years. SRI assets reached $6.57 trillion at the start of 2014, up from $3.74 trillion. So, according to 480 institutional investors, 308 money managers, and 880 community investment institutions participating in the survey, the top reason for offering SEG products remains client demand. You know, people are just begging to have their money invested irresponsibly on the basis of racial makeup. From Echo Chamber, BlackRock and WEF currently control multinational corporations with an ESG social credit score. Their next mission is to control individuals with ESG credits, social credit scores, forcing them to digital ID. And this, of course, was all the way back in 2021, but it was well on its way then. And it simply lays out the process by which they created this, as they put it, quote, standard global model to enable people to securely document their participation in ESG DEI hiring. This is unfortunate. In 2014, Larry Fink was writing letters to the leaders of some of the largest publicly listed companies pushing ESG. 2014. This is Buckman at 21 on X. Larry Fink at BlackRock, purpose to profit. In 2014, Larry Fink started writing letters to leaders of some of the largest publicly listed companies, urging them to consider the importance of environmental, social, and governance issues. Fink is the chairman and CEO of BlackRock, one of the largest asset management houses in the country, or in the world, rather. The firm's success was rooted in its cost-effective passive investment products that rely more on tracking indices and companies. But Fink wanted his firm to engage with the companies in which they invest and hold them accountable for their social and environmental impacts. See how this works? See, they went from being an investment firm that tried to make money for their clients by investing in profitable enterprises to then taking their influence, taking the power that they wield through the management of other people's money, to then impose their own worldview on the people of the world through the companies that we have to interact with. It changed the hiring metrics. It changed what shows were picked up. It changed what products were offered. All of this came about by demand from on high, from Larry Fink at BlackRock, Klaus Schwab at the New World Order, at World Economic Forum. So as you read the article, The Lost Generation, they never address where this came from. They address how it manifested. They address sort of what it felt like to be in the rooms when this took place. But they never tell you that this was not some sort of spontaneously manifesting mental contagion that swept through the country. That's sort of how it's presented, as if, just invisible forces were just occurring in people's minds. No. The banks, with all the money, told all the corporations, if you want our money, you'll stop hiring white people. So that's what the corporations did. And they first targeted the media and news outlets so that they could frame this discrimination as a positive thing by packing the newsrooms with far leftist anti-white activists who could rhetorically justify the blatant discrimination that was being imposed from on high from Wall Street and Larry frickin' Fink. But it's not just them. But it wasn't just them, because obviously, when you talk about BlackRock, when you talk about these multinational corporations, you're also talking about the U.S. government. Because it wasn't just the richest companies in the history of the world who control trillions of dollars of your money to manipulate corporations, to bend them to your will. The U.S. government was involved in this as well. Are you surprised? UNPR proliferated ESG and related woke nonsense via their vast and supremely powerful transnational unelected unaccountable organization. This is an NGO. Since when? 2014, they have trained over 20,000 people on ESG. Signatories sit on a 121 million in AUM, and they must comply or explain the six principles. UNPR made formerly sane investors into climate activists and woke nutters. Al Gore is their fiduciary guru. Okay, so we got the U.S. government, things like USAID, funding the propaganda to justify the restrictions that are being commanded by BlackRock. You know the Rockefellers are going to want in on this. You know the Rockefellers aren't missing this party. The Rockefeller Brothers Fund's 2014 divestment strategy centered on aligning investments with their philanthropic pivot towards climate activism, publicly rejecting fossil fuels to lead by example in ESG trends and influence global policy. It preserved family legacy influence by redirecting capital to renewable and advocacy, hedging against regulatory shifts they helped foster. Conspiratorially, it likely enabled cashing out atop mature oil empires before orchestrating a controlled scarcity narrative, steering society towards centralized higher-cost energy system for elite control. Wow, isn't that interesting that in the exact year that is identified by the author of the Compact magazine as the year that everything went to crap, that ESG and DEI firmly got rooted in the, you know, media landscape as well as the wider, you know, industry landscape of America, happened to be the year that Larry Fink started writing letters about this, that the World Economic Forum decided to make this a center point of their policy program. Andrew of the Rockefeller Foundation, sovereign wealth fund, deciding that actually, you know, we're not just capitalists, we're philanthropists. Okay, we're going to help people by forcing them to change their behavior and destroy their traditions, or else we'll withhold the precious money. In the World Economic Forum in 2014, at the Davos meeting, what do you think it was called? Why we need a new kind of capitalism. Well, we got it. Oh, we got the new kind of capitalism. It's not capitalism. And do you notice who wrote this article? It's literally a Rothschild. Lynn Forster de Rothschild decides in 2014, we need a new kind of capitalism that discriminates against white people for racial justice and refuses to invest in any Western industry that uses fossil fuel while simultaneously giving out billions of dollars to China, who's building coal power plants faster than you can name them. But it doesn't matter because, you know, we're really, moral and driven by this righteous crusade to fix the world, you know, not the China part of the world, not the Africa part of the world, not the Middle East part of the world, but the European and white American world. We're going to fix that by destroying the people that built it. Thanks, guys. Wonderful. So in 2014, the Rothschilds and World Economic Forum decide that we need a new kind of capitalism. And what do you know? Everything goes to hell ever since. What a surprise. You also had BlackRock hiring as their managing director of investment stewardship team, Michelle Edkins, in 2014. She was extremely motivated by DEI and helped usher in ESG scores with their International Corporate Governance Network and Aspen Institute. Diversity matters. This was actually published by McKinsey and Company, another major, think piece from these think tanks coming out and informing, you know, the highest level C-suite executives in America that diversity is actually the thing you should be prioritizing when you're thinking about hiring. And they actually, you know, provide all this justification for it, which is really interesting. Really interesting. Because what you have here, this again, written by McKinsey and Company, published in 2014, or maybe in 2013, this edition's from 2015. But they make this case with all sorts of charts, with very complicated math. We can go to the dot cam here and see some of, you know, all of the intelligence that they bring to bear. I mean, all of this complicated math to measure diversity and, you know, it's the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index for diversity with all this very complicated math. And we have all of these charts to prove how diversity correlates to performance. And, they make this case over the course of about 50 pages. And then we fast forward 12 years and everybody that believed this hogwash, everybody that bought the slop they were selling, is on the verge of absolute collapse and bankruptcy and insolvency. Who were the institutions that most forcefully and enthusiastically imposed DEI ESG restrictions? Hollywood, film production, mainstream media news. Name two industries that might not make it to the year 2030. Two industries who have absolutely, utterly, and completely collapsed over the last 10 years. So it's one of these brilliant examples where we get to look at the very sophisticated, well-reasoned, well-argued, rhetorically fascinating arguments from places like McKinsey telling you why diversity is such a powerful and good thing. People listen to them, and now we have the conclusion to the testing of the hypothesis. And it turns out that they were asked backwards the entire time, obviously. Because you don't need to be a genius. I don't need to use complicated math to tell you that if the thing you're judging people on when hiring them is how far away from white males they are in the, you know, diversity continuum. You don't need to be a genius for me to tell you that's a stupid way to judge profitability. That is a dumb way to do investments. That is a stupid method to determine who to hire and who not to hire. You're going to fail. Fast forward 12 years, they're all failing abjectly, even with ESG investment funds. Do you understand that? Do you understand why these companies made this calculation and decided to go along with it? Because think about it for a second. They run the calculus and they go, okay, if we hire the best person, they likely will increase our profits by $10 million a year. If we hire the not best person, they only increase our profits by $5 million a year. Okay, the best person is a $5 million bonus. But here comes BlackRock to say your ESG score will determine whether you get $100 million of investment. And so corporations choose the thing that would make them money in normal capitalism, or they choose the thing that would lose them money in normal capitalism, hiring the less capable person, selling the less popular products, in any normal system would result in a lower profitability. But because BlackRock imposes this artificial metric and then fulfills it by pumping these organizations full of money for complying to their DEI ESG score, then it turns out it is actually more profitable to hire the less profitable person because the lack of profits is made up for and then some from the investments from the people in the banks in New York who decide they want to use your money to control the world. So again, 2014 was the year, and it was not a coincidence. It was not an accident. That was the year. That was the year that World Economic Forum, the BlackRocks, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, and the American government decided to make the world this way. In fact, the title of the Davos meeting in Switzerland for the World Economic Forum, their 44th annual 2014 meeting in Davos, was called Reshaping the World: Consequences for Society, Politics, and Business. And this was when they started the codification of the ESG DEI madness, the mental plague that has literally destroyed our country in a way that may be irreparable. And all of this really gets to the height of absurdity when, again, you look at this as an objective viewer, as an alien species. This paragraph is so monumentally retarded, it's hard to explain. In the aftermath of George Floyd's death, newsrooms tripped over themselves to stage a, quote, reckoning. New York Times solemnly promised sweeping reforms on top of the sweeping reforms it had already promised. The Washington Post declared it would become the most diverse and inclusive newsroom in the country. CNN pledged a sustained commitment to race coverage, while Bon Appetit confessed that our mastheads have been far too white for far too long, and that the magazine had tokenized many BIPOC staffers and contributors. NPR went further still, declaring that diversity was nothing less than its North Star, its ultimate guiding light. All of this as a consequence of one black dude's overdose death in Michigan or Minnesota or wherever. Do you understand how insane this is? Do you understand how dislocated from reality this paragraph is? In response to a non-existent phenomenon of racism, that white police officers were killing black people, just literally wasn't happening. You get one example of a black guy overdosing, dying in police custody. That becomes a narrative that black people are being genocided by white police. And in response, every newsroom in America says we are now dedicating our coverage to destroying white people, and we're not hiring white people, and we're not letting white people speak about this. All because some random career criminal took too much fentanyl. What are we talking about?
Ladies and gentlemen, Nitric Boost, the all-time fan favorite, is now back in stock at InfoWarsStore.com.
You've looked at our formula. You like it?
I did, and I do. Yes. Well, nitric oxide is a key. It's made by our own bodies again. It's made by L-citrulline and L-arginine, the amino acids.
And now a major shipment has finally come back in for those of you that want to be able to stock up on it at InfoWarsStore.com. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Judy Mikovits, without me even knowing she'd gotten it and used it, came on years ago and said this was the best spike protein detoxer she found.
Just like you want your own body to make vitamin D from the sunlight, you can't force it back in people who can't make it. It can actually hurt them. It's called peroxynitrites. So you want to boost your own body's ability. The nitric oxide relaxes the endothelium, the vasculature. It relaxes the vein. So I use the two, your InfoWars. I keep that on my shelf, and I feed myself the Cardio Miracle, which is just for straight food. It's a different formulation than that one, and the two together are a 1-2 punch. So you get in your food the ability to make what you need and no more.
Because of the organic-based compounds that are in it that cause vasodilation in the blood vessels, in the arteries, in the veins, in the capillaries. And it just does so many other great things.
So constricted blood vessels too, because athletes are running, they're constricted, they're working so that the blood flows and it doesn't flow, which is why your nitric oxide product, that new product, I hope you'll show it, because that's a very important thing to have for acute events. Dissolve under the tongue, give you an instant relaxing of your endothelium, your vasculature.
Now listen, it is already a nationwide best-selling bodybuilding product for over 20 years. Bodybuilders take it as it helps grow muscles and better workouts and things. I was just researching and wanting to put something out that was good for the heart and talked to a lot of scientists and researchers on it, and they said, well, these are the type of ingredients we were thinking about putting out a product. When I talked to formulators, they said, well, we actually already have a product that has that, so we private labeled it as Nitric Boost. And just for men in the morning when you wake up, that's the big thing people feel and see right away. So imagine what else it's doing for your body. So for those of you that love Nitric Boost, it's back in stock right now at InfoWarsStore.com. And for those that haven't tried Nitric Boost, you are really missing out. Secure your Nitric Boost right now at InfoWarsStore.com. We're battling in the courts. We're still here a year after the Onion said they bought us. We might actually hold on and win. But regardless, the shopping cart's there. The shipments are going out, and you will get your product. But if you don't order it, support us, we'll be off the air. So it's a paradox. So please take action now at InfoWarsStore.com and experience Nitric Boost for yourself. And listen, men feel it in that one way. Women love it as well. It's good for men and women. Get your Nitric Boost now, right now, exclusively at InfoWarsStore.com. And thanks for being the reason, one way or another, we'll always be on the air. InfoWarsStore.com, Nitric Boost, back in stock.
Welcome to the Great Reset. Eat the bugs. You will own nothing, and you will be happy. Take the vaccine. Trust the science. Get your booster.
Every crisis is an opportunity, and the world will be reshaped in our vision.
Down with the globalists. Get ultramethylene red at thealexjonesstore.com.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Santa baby, slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful
good
girl,
welcome back, folks.
Santa baby, so hurry down the...
There's some breaking news here. MIT professor shot and killed in his Massachusetts home. An MIT professor was shot and killed in his Brooklyn, Massachusetts home on Monday night. 47-year-old Nuno Loureiro, I think, a nuclear scientist and engineering professor, was shot multiple times. He was transported to a Boston hospital where he died Tuesday morning. A neighbor told CBS News they heard three loud bangs on Monday night. There is no suspect in custody. And he's an engineering professor that was just made was just put in charge of the MIT Plasma Science Infusion Center. Lorero is taking the helms of MIT, of one of MIT's largest labs. More than 250 full-time researchers, staff members, and students work and study in seven buildings with nearly a quarter million square feet of lab space. A theoretical physicist and fusion scientist, Lorero joined MIT as a faculty member in 2016 and was appointed deputy director of the Plasma and Science Fusion Center, Plasma Science and Fusion Center in 2022. So that is interesting. And, I'm not sure if we have any updates to this. So far, there's been no suggestion of a motive or even a potential suspect, but it doesn't sound like the neighbors didn't report hearing a big fight or anything. So again, the lack of information leads us at a loss here. Even if we just knew, like, did he die at his front door? Did the person, was the person in the house? Did they break in? Were they let in? I mean, that would really inform what the motive behind this was. But of course, for this to be a random attack is almost, you know, the possibility of that is almost non-existent. And the idea that this highly decorated, obviously brilliant engineer at MIT would have such a dysfunctional personal life, I guess it's possible. But there's also the political implications of things like, you know, nuclear cold fusion. And if you follow that sort of stuff, you know that there are a lot of companies making some major strides in this. And it's probably be by this time next year, there will be functional mini nuclear reactors on the market. In fact, China has claimed they're developing a like coin sized nuclear battery that could last for something like 50 years. It's like the stuff that people assumed we would have, like if you read sci-fi written in the 50s, like the Foundation book by Isaac Asimov, and it was just assumed that, like, all right, in a couple of years, we're going to have miniaturized this nuclear energy thing, and energy will be free, and we'll all be able to power everything by little battery packs that never extinguish. Now, if that were to happen, you know, alternative free energy is kind of like the Jeffrey Epstein list of politics or of industry. It's like it would be an absolute positive for it to get released. It would also probably cause the world to crash. So I guess you have to weigh your options. But we'll bring you any information as we get it. But again, very little data about that shooting at MIT. Or of an MIT professor at his home. But it's just the latest in a series of insane headlines that I don't think will be slowing down anytime soon. Now, again, I feel like anybody watching me just sort of already knows everything in this Lost Generation article. And I've been talking about it for a while, so I'll move on. But I encourage you, it's a impactful read. And they talk about the endless diversity trainings, a racial climate assessment. At one point, reporters were told they had to catalog in minute detail the identity characteristics of all of their sources. And it's like, yeah, okay. We know. I mean, do we not remember Kamala Harris? I am a black woman. I'm wearing a sweater. Like, no, this became a thing. It's like a religion, you know, like a prayer, a chant that you say, you identify your characteristics, I guess, on the assumption that somebody out there might be blind. Like, I don't know why they do it. It's a religion. It's performative. It's to signal that they are a part of the trusted group who understands the mission they're all involved in to destroy white people and act like moral superiors while they do it. The irony was, where older white men remained in charge, especially where they remained in charge, there was almost no room to move up. If you hired a team of white guys around you, you were putting a target on your back, recalled a hiring editor. At the New York Times Magazine, one of the few prestige magazines with a public masthead, Jake Silverstein, a Gen X white man, debatably, serves as an editor-in-chief, and Bill Wasik, another Gen Z white man, serves as editorial director, but of nine millennial senior editors and two story editors below them, there's just one white guy, and he's been there since 2012, effectively grandfathered in. So that's sort of the point of this story, is it was all of these older executives who were basically happy to screw over their own progeny, happy to screw over people that are like them to prevent what would have been their, you know, rise through the corporation. They were happy to shut the door behind them and get all the praise and laudits of, you know, hiring people on the basis of their race, even when they're less qualified and less capable. In the early 2000s, many journalists I spoke to noticed something else. The young white men who once flooded internship and fellowship pools had simply stopped applying. Gen Z had absorbed the message that journalism was not for them. Now, I'd like to make a caveat to that. They've realized that mainstream journalism is not for them. So instead, we set up the alternative media, which is kicking the establishment, aka anti-white media's ass in every direction. So like, again, that's the other takeaway from this is like, all right, all of these industries, these three particular industries, entertainment, news, and academia, all systematically eliminated white people, have all completely failed over the last decade. And instead, there's been a rise of alternatives to all three of these institutions that are succeeding where the mainstream fails. Because white people. Because it turns out we don't need to be grandfathered into a pre-existing system. It turns out the best people will just create the best things even if you try to stop them. Isn't that interesting? They follow the story of this guy, Andrew, as he is battered around all of these newsrooms full of obnoxious lesbians. And this type of stuff is so, like, I don't want to be too, like, condemn these people too much, but they do kind of deserve it. They say the demographic shift was reshaped not only by who told the stories, but which stories got told. After George Floyd's death, Andrew's colleague Lucas was assigned a piece about why you should never call the police. I remember having to interview one of these abolitionists for a story about how if somebody breaks into your car or your home, it's white supremacy to call the cops, even if you need it for an insurance report, Lucas told me. That always made me feel gross. I think back on that with a lot of regret. Yeah, you should. Yeah, you should. Why did you go along with that? What an absurd thing to write a story about. But you went along with it. Why did you go along with it? Why did you do that? You know, I try to be understanding. I get not everybody's red-pilled. People just want to get along. They're not looking for a fight. They just want. But the point of this article is like the fight is here. You don't have an option not to engage. Your life is going to be destroyed if you don't engage. If you don't stop this where it is. If you don't make that sacrifice. And what I really don't understand is how they implemented this in every boardroom in America and nobody thought to sue. Not one person had the balls to go, if you fire me because I'm white, I'm suing this company to kingdom come. You cannot discriminate against me like that. How dare you first discriminate against me and then openly talk about it? I'll see you in court. How did, out of the tens of thousands of people this happened to, nobody thought to file a lawsuit? Nobody thought to make a big stink out of this and go to the media and decry it? You know, to tell you the truth, there probably were people that wanted to do that. It was probably the lawyers and the media themselves that said, the story's not worth telling. Your case isn't worth pursuing. Because this was a deliberate, top-down, all-of-society manufactured, organized crusade against white people. And we were left to hang out to dry. These are all my dudes. This is my age bracket, people I grew up with, my friends who, despite being incredibly talented and trustworthy and hardworking, at least half of them struggle to find a job. Multiple of my friends have been the victims of, you know, deliberate H-1B replacement. Or in the case of Whole Foods, I've told this story a lot. I had a friend at Whole Foods who's like, yeah, I'm kind of confused. Like, we keep firing people, but then like we hire people also. So it's like, okay, if we're firing this guy, like this guy has a lot of experience. We've worked with him a lot, but then they hire some woman. I'm like, dude, they're trying to beef up their diversity score because they're being sold. This was right when Whole Foods was being sold to Amazon, and they were literally going through the, you know, executive wing of Whole Foods, the, you know, headquarters there, and just eliminating all the white guys they could so they could hire minorities so they could present that as their ESG score to get the best price from Amazon when they were sold. And I'm sure everybody my age has stories like that. So like, this is not anything new to me. It's my friend just texted me about this story, and I go, oh, I've been talking about this for 30 minutes. She goes, you've been talking about this for years. It's like, yeah, actually that's true. Like, I'm telling you, that was back in like 2012, maybe 2013, something like that. Maybe it was 2014. When was Whole Foods sold to Amazon? Cause that was as far back that, again, it's like, was I some sort of super genius? Did I have some sort of crystal ball? I was predicting the future. I was reading the Compact Magazine article from 2025. No, I looked around and went, oh, they're firing the white guys and hiring non-white women. That's what's happening. Like, it's crazy. It's been 13 years and people still haven't they still don't understand this. They still don't get it. It's happening to you. It's crazy. This type of stuff where it's like, yeah, this is wrong, dude. You shouldn't be okay with this. They go along with it. So again, like, this is my cohort and these are my friends that could not find jobs. This is me, actually. Now that I think about it, this is very much me. Of course, I understood that this was happening. So, you know, around 2015 or so, it was like, well, time to give up on ever trying to make it in Hollywood. Better get involved in the real fight. It's just brutal. Andrew, for his part, was unable to adopt the performative allyship that had become expected. Quote, I always thought I was an effeminate nerd growing up, but my way of expressing myself now puts me in the most masculine end of men in media. I started to pick up on the fact that there wasn't much room for people who even speak in my timbre. So here's this guy who's like, he's not a particularly masculine guy. He thinks of himself as an effeminate nerd. But journalism has become so gay. He's like, I was the most manly voice out there. Which isn't about just like mocking the effeminate twinks that run our media. It's about understanding what that does to the entire atmosphere of the office. It's what it does to anybody who's a serious worker that wants to actually achieve things. It might seem subtle, but even just that little difference between like, hey, you need to give me that thing right now. And hey, look, I know you're really busy. If you have time, I'd love if you would grab me that. Don't worry about it if you don't have time. You do. Oh my God. Thank you so much. Like, repeat that 10 million times. Repeat that thousands of times a day in thousands of different companies all over the country. And what you're dealing with is a major barrier to productivity, especially in a newsroom. If you have this atmosphere of everybody, and let me just say, this in and of itself is a little bit deceptive. Because this whole effeminate, empathetic, let's say things a little bit nicer and let's give people, you know, she's on a mental ill break today. So you have to do her work because she's getting her nails done. It's called self-care. Like, all of that attitude gives you the impression that everybody is soft, that everybody is a pussy. That's not really the case though, is it? They aren't exactly soft and empathetic when they talk about white people, are they? When they talk about men, are they? So this is the real thing. It's bad enough if everything you say has to be put in this preschool HR baby speak to not offend the delicate disposition of the, you know, complete retard that got hired when they shouldn't have. which is another thing, right? Okay, you're hiring incompetent people, but they, you have to take their feelings into account. And so if they're incompetent, you don't want to, I mean, you definitely don't want to fire them. That would look really bad. And you really don't want to try to correct them because, you know, you're a white male correcting a black woman. That kind of looks bad, doesn't it? So you kind of have to work even harder to make up for the lack of competency in your ESG DEI hire coworkers. And, you have to thank them for the privilege, right? But all that falls away when these very same people tilting their head and doing the little bird chirping hand motion as they tell you, you need to be more aware of the people in the office and the way that you behave, right? The minute it comes to white people or men or Christians or whatever else, it's like, well, I just think they should all need to be burned. Maybe they should be castrated. Am I right? And it's like, these people aren't soft. They aren't just empathetic to everybody. They're vicious, hateful monsters that use the social pressure, use the social, impact of this faux empathy to force you to capitulate to their demands. That's what's happening. Okay. So I thought I'd mention that. It's also effeminate. It's like, that doesn't mean it's nice. It doesn't mean it's uplifting or beneficent. That means it's backhanded and insincere and more vicious than otherwise. They say white men may still be 55% of Harvard's arts and science faculty, down from 63% a decade ago, but this is a legacy of boomer and Gen X employment patterns for tenure track positions, the pipeline for future faculty. White men have gone from 49% in 2014 to 27% in 2024. In the humanities, they've gone from 39 to 21%. As again, this article is just full of stats to just show the complete cratering of, you know, the percentage of white people in any of these organizations, again, most particularly entertainment, academia, and news journalism. A whistleblower sent me a document from early 2017, an internal needs sheet compiled by a major talent agency that shows just how steep the headwinds were. Across the grid, which tracks staffing needs for TV writer's room, the same shorthand appears dozens of times, quote, diverse, female, women, and diverse only. These mandates came from some of the most powerful names in television. This was systematic discrimination, documented in writing, implemented without consequence. It's striking how casual it all is. And they quote people just outright saying, Chicago Fire, the show, the upper level can be anybody, but we need diverse staff writers. As in other industries, upper level positions, writers with experience and credits could still be filled by white men, but the entry level jobs, the staff writers and co-producer positions that Matt and thousands of other aspiring writers were competing for, were completely reserved for others. So just stopping them from ever breaking in. And of course, the ultimate irony, I'll just repeat, is that TV sucks now. Movies suck now. Hollywood can't make its money. It can't come up with any new films. It's regurgitating the same slop over and over and over and over again, to the point that now we've got remakes of reissues of, converted TV shows that were based on a book originally in a comic book. And it's like, they've got nothing, no creativity, no compelling stories, no impactful narratives, no bombshell blockbuster surprises. No, I mean, and it's everywhere. The big budget slop is unwatchable. The small budget slop doesn't even exist. Netflix is filled with a bunch of gay propaganda, and not a lot else. Hey, maybe you should bring the white guys back. Maybe there was a reason that white people were there and it had nothing to do with their skin color. Because see, all of this nonsense, hogwash discrimination against white people is all predicated on the assumed falsehood that white people only got their positions because they were hired because they were white. That never existed in this country. Maybe 100 years ago, you could make that case. But certainly for the lifetime of anybody still walking around, white people are not given their jobs because they're white. White people are not given a leg up because they're white. We earn our positions. And then you fire the people that have earned their positions, and then you do the thing that you're fighting that didn't exist. Now it does exist because you're doing it in reverse, and now everything sucks. without exception. And everybody knows it. They just won't look to the obvious reasons why. Over Matt's 14 years in Hollywood, the changes have been staggering. In 2011, when he and the author moved to California, white men were around 60% of TV writers. By 2025, according to the WGO's own diversity statistics, they account for just 11.9% of lower-level writers. Women of color made up 34.6%. White men directed 69% of TV episodes in 2014 and just 34% by 2021. From 60%, which is actually equivalent to the population, if you are actually going for a boardroom that looks like the real world, a boardroom that looks like America, then 60% is literally exactly what you would want. They don't want that. They want 12%. So now 60% of the population operates in 12% of the positions, and they call that equality. They call that representation. That would be like, I'm trying to figure out the equivalent. So if 60% of the men are of the writers become 12% more or less, that's a factor of five, right? So if black people are 15%, that'd be like a corporation where only 3% of their boardroom was black when they're 15% of the population. Right? Factor of five by how underrepresented they are. So Hollywood and the mainstream media looks at TV shows where black people are overrepresented, where 20% of the cast is black, and they say it needs to be 50% because we want it to look like real America when the population of real America is 60% white, less than 15% black. Do I even need to explain any of this? Does any of this mean anything? It's like, I've just spent an hour and a half talking about this discrimination, and I could keep going for hours litigating every single little aspect of this. At the end of the day, all you need to know is that there was a deliberate, top-down, banker-designed, World Economic Forum, Rothschild, Rockefeller-designed agenda to discriminate against white people, to create animus towards white people, to seed the American media with stories and narratives depicting white people as evil in order to justify their blatant, abject, obvious, out in the open discrimination against white people, even though it was illegal, even though it was against logic, even though it was just offensive on the face of it. They got away with it because they rolled this out in a sophisticated fashion over a decade. That is a decade of young men loss, a decade of geniuses toiling away in anonymity, no institutional support. On the other hand, it's also been a decade of an astonishing rise of the alternative media, an astonishing rise of Substack and InfoWars and live streaming and entertainment that doesn't come from Hollywood. So they thought that they could just, you know, quietly do this and we wouldn't even notice. Everyone notices even if we don't notice. Everyone knows movies suck now even if they don't know why. Everybody knows the media can't be trusted even if they can't put their finger on it. So that in and of itself is kind of good news. And by the way, you want to support the talented white guys? You want to support the meritocratic white guys that got here on our own volition? TheAlexJonesStore.com. We get no legs up. We have you, the American people, and nothing else. Good thing that is more than enough.
Ladies and gentlemen, Nitric Boost, the all-time fan favorite, is now back in stock at InfoWarsStore.com. You've looked at our formula. You like it?
I did, and I do, yes. Well, nitric oxide is a key. It's made by our own bodies again. It's made by L-citrulline and L-arginine, the amino acids.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Judy Mikovits, without me even knowing she'd gotten it and used it, came on years ago and said this was the best spike protein detoxer she'd found.
So you want to boost your own body's ability. The nitric oxide relaxes the endothelium, the vasculature. It relaxes the vein. So I use the two, your InfoWars. I keep that on my shelf. And I feed myself the Cardio Miracle, which is just for straight food. It's a different formulation than that one. And the two together are a 1-2 punch. So you get in your food the ability to make what you need and no more.
It is already a nationwide best-selling bodybuilding product for over 20 years.
bodybuilders take is it helps grow muscles and better workouts and things. So for those of you that love Nitric Boost, it's back in stock right now at InfoWarsStore.com. And for those that haven't tried Nitric Boost, you are really missing out. Secure your Nitric Boost right now at InfoWarsStore.com. We're battling in the courts. We're still here. A year after the Onion said they bought us, we might actually hold on and win. But regardless, the shopping cart's there, the shipments are going out, and you will get your product. But if you don't order it and support us, we'll be off the air. So please take action now at InfoWarsStore.com and experience Nitric Boost for yourself. It's good for men and women. Get your Nitric Boost now, right now, exclusively at InfoWarsStore.com. And thanks for being the reason, one way or another, we'll always be on the air. InfoWarsStore.com, Nitric Boost, back in stock.
This is the War Room. Third hour is on. We're connecting with my guest, Andrew F. Branca, right now. Very excited to talk to him. And I imagine we'll probably continue to discuss this compact article, or at least the, you know, anti-white agenda of the powers that be, since he talks about that quite a bit from a very sophisticated position of knowledge. But just to close out here, and then I want to go to a video of Branca that he published a few days ago. I just want to read the last sentence, really, of this Compact Magazine article, because I have an answer. He asked a question, and I have an answer for him, okay? Again, the whole thing is heartbreaking, and he basically talks about contending with the fact, like coming to terms with the fact that he's never going to be the success that he thought he should have been, and trying to get over some of the, like, hatred that he feels for the people that he felt gatekept him out of what he should have been able to earn. He says, there's wounded pride here. How could there not be? I have two sons. I used to imagine long before they were born that I would take them to film sets, that I'd bring them along to exotic locations. Instead, their father spends most of his working day in his bedroom scrolling through spreadsheets and ticket listings. What do I say when my boys ask about my old hopes and dreams? What do I tell them when they ask about theirs? Well, you pathetic, sad sack, you need to buck up, bucko. Your children are probably going to have to actually literally fight for their lives against the same forces that have depressed and beaten you down. So what you need to tell your kids is not be sad, oh, they screwed us over, oh, poor white men. Tell them you have to fight for everything that you earn. And there are people out there that are very sophisticated and are very capable and are very evil and are using it to discriminate against you because you represent something they're not. You represent something that they can't achieve. And that's a burden on you, but it's also a brilliant gift. And you have to take that and you have to fight for everything that you've got. And you have to understand that this is the world, and you don't pass on to your kid the race-blind egalitarianism that left you a victim of all of this bull crap. You need to tell them what's really going on, what the real world is about. Not that they're victims, not that it's hopeless, but that they're going to have to get serious, and they're going to have to start early, and they're playing like Maximus in the last fight of Gladiator. They've been stabbed in the liver. They've been abused and starved and tortured, and now they have to go out in the arena and fight for their life. And the good news is they're more than capable of winning. I understand, and I empathize with, and I think it's important to illustrate and to discuss the tragedy that this represents, the individual tragedies of lost hopes, lost dreams, feeling inadequate, passing that on to your children. It's important to illustrate that, but I have to say this article has a defeatist attitude that I can't stomach. Oh, my old hopes and dreams. Okay, so you were delusional when you were young. Big deal. To even have two children that you live with is a success. And all, like, again, just tell your kids, just let your sons know the world is unfair. Tribe up. That's what you tell them. Tell them, I got screwed by this system, but you don't have to. And when it comes time to send them to school, if the school tries to teach them to hate themselves, tries to teach them inaccurate views of history, and you don't sigh, you don't shrug your shoulders and roll your eyes and say, oh, woe is me. You go to the school and you figuratively kick the goddamn door down and demand that they stop poisoning the mind of your child. You start acting like everybody else in your story. Throughout this whole story, there's the cynical, exploitative old white boomers. There's the cowardly little gay millennials. There's the Gen Z twinks. Nowhere is there just white people not putting up with it, not standing for it, not feeling sorry for themselves, but being invigorated by the fact that you're now in a fight for your life. And that you can win, and that it's fun to win, and that it makes the victory mean something against these odds.
Challenging all of you to support the broadcast, keep us on air while you get great products, and it's a win-win. We need funds, we are in the red, and we've got to be able to continue our legal battles. We've got to be able to continue to buy new product going in the future. We've got to continue with the funding to build the Alex Jones backup network in case they're able to shut us down. I cannot do it without you, so now is the time to go to thealexjonesstore.com and do your final Christmas shopping there. Anywhere in the United States, if you order by Friday, you will get it before Christmas. So get your orders in now. Do your Christmas shopping with us, but really give yourself the gift of health with our creatine gummies, the highest quality type of creatine, 5 milligrams. That's a daily serving per gummy. Huge container of them. Such a great deal. This is the best creatine out there. There's so many other great products and a whole bunch of other sales and deals. You can become a subscriber right now on any product, cancel any time, and it reorders every month and get 50% off on all future orders. The widest selection of t-shirts, hoodies, ball caps, sweaters, many of them limited edition at thealexjonesstore.com.
You're tuned into the War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now on X.com.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. You support InfoWars by going to thealexjonesstore.com. Go there today, take advantage of the incredible sales that we have, and get your order in by New Year's so you can start the new year off right, hitting your resolution goals with all of the supplementation that can help get you there, thealexjonesstore.com. With that, I'm very happy to welcome my guest, Andrew F. Branca, attorney and host of The Branca Show, providing a pro-American, pro-Constitution, pro-Western civilization, political and legal analysis with bonus jokes and laughter along with it. You can follow him on X at The Branca Show. That's T-H-E-B-R-A-N-C-A show, and youtube.com/@TheBranca Show. Mr. Branca, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, and I don't know how I didn't find you earlier, but ever since you started showing up on my X feed, I'm like, I got to get this guy on. Yesterday, I asked our producer, Scott, to reach out, and he said, well, is there anything in particular that you want to talk to him about? And I'm like, I think I could talk to him about anything. You cover a wide swath of topics, and you seem to have in-depth knowledge of just about everything you discuss. Is there an area of expertise that you have? How'd you get started doing this, and what compels you to speak out like this?
I mean, by profession, I'm a criminal defense attorney. I specialize in self-defense law. That's my day job, thelawofselfdefense.com. But I've been on the planet for 60 years, 61 years this week. And I've seen things happening. I have some life experience. I have some perspectives. And I would start to talk to people about these things on social media, what's happening in the world today. And it became obvious to me that I saw things that were quite obvious to me based on my life experience that were not obvious to them. And it was a situation where I would point something out. And once they saw it, they could not unsee it. The reality became clear to them. But I realized that until it was pointed out, they were blinded by the propaganda that's out there in the mainstream media, the legacy media, the institutions. I found I really enjoyed opening people's eyes to a different perspective of what was really going on and help them understand their place in the world and what they could do to, well, stop being abused by the world as we are today.
Well, and the way you do it, you have sort of a unique style, because what you're saying feels like it should be offensive, but the way you do it is just very sort of straightforward. And I that maybe sounds bad when I say that, but obviously you talk about very sensitive issues. You talk about political hot button issues, but you just sort of give the facts, right? And you don't really get, you know, too caught up in the emotions of it. Is that a strategy of yours? Is that just the way you are in general? Do you even, are you aware of this, or is that just, my perspective on your work?
You know, I just try to be factual. Unfortunately, a lot of facts make people emotionally uncomfortable. So I've grown accustomed to people reacting with estrogenic hysteria to things that are just facts, because it basically hurts their feelings or it makes them feel bad about their place in the world. We live in a world where everyone's supposed to simultaneously be a winner at all the things. And that's just not true. Different people have different strengths and weaknesses. I'm not good at everything, but everyone else is not good at everything either. And I think it's helpful to have a realistic sense of what we are capable of and what we're not, and make our public policy and personal choices accordingly.
Yeah, and you bring a very legal perspective, and that's what I really like about your work, because a lot of times you get talking heads discussing this stuff, and they go all sorts of directions. One video that I really liked of yours was talking about Judge Boasberg and the way that he was trying to hold the Trump administration in contempt, and I had no idea of how absurd it was, but then you laid it out really simply. Can you, not to redo your video here live, but can you explain sort of what's going on with Judge Boasberg and the Trump administration, and he's trying to hold them in contempt?
Yeah, I mean, I find it's always very useful to go back to first principles, especially as a lawyer, and start from there, because the progressive left loves to obscure things with endless complexity to hide from you what's really going on. It's like these guys in the subway platforms with their cups and the little ball under the cup, and you're supposed to guess which one it is. That's why they come up with this fake academic type of language that they use. It's all just an effort, an obfuscation. Boasberg set a trap for Trump. And we know he set a trap, because months before, right after Trump was reelected, but before he was sworn in, Boasberg was at a judicial conference. Chief Justice John Roberts was there. By the way, Boasberg's lifelong friends. I think they might have roomed in law school together.
Yeah.
And Boasberg, I call him Count Boasberg, because of his vampiric appearance, right. Chief Judge of the District of Columbia, District Court, Federal Courts. He stands up at the conference and he says, "Hey, I just want to plant a seed in all the federal judges' minds. We should be ready for when Trump disobeys our court orders." And Chief Justice John Roberts is there and says, "Hey, what are you talking about? There's no indication he's going to do this. Why are we inviting trouble? If that happens, we'll address it. But let's not presume that'll be the case." And then months later, Boasberg happens to be in his office, home early from vacation, at 1 o'clock in the morning, in his chambers. And he's not the emergency judge assigned for the weekend, but at 1 o'clock in the morning, he's in his chambers and he catches the first Alien Enemies Act civil suit that's filed against Trump. Just happens to be there.
What a coincidence.
And then he has a hearing about it. And at the hearing, he says, "Listen, I'm going to talk about a bunch of stuff in the hearing. I don't want the Trump administration, you lawyers for Trump, I don't want you taking any notes. At the end of the meeting, I'll issue a written order that tells you what to do." And he issues a written order. They follow the written order to the letter. And now he's saying the oral comments I told you not to take notes on, well, that was also an order and you didn't obey those. So I'm going to hold you in criminal contempt of court. It was purely a trap set by him.
And this was about the extradition flights to El Salvador, right? And the discrepancy was he said you can't send any more flights, but he didn't say anything about pulling the flights back that were already en route. But then, you know, it's found out that, well, their one flight had already left. Landed after he gave the order, he says, "You disobeyed my order." But in the written order, there said nothing about bringing people back, only no more planes were to be sent. It's impossible to not send a plane that was already sent before the written order. So just, and again, my question is, like, how does he get away with this? Because that seems so blatant to me. If it's not in the written order, how is he claiming that they're not following the written order? Like, how do they keep getting away with this stuff?
Well, we let them. And by we, of course, I mean the system. There are ways to hold judges in check. I mean, you can impeach them in the House and vote to remove them in the Senate. You need 67 votes for that. We don't have 67 votes. All these judges know it. The Supreme Court could hold these judges in check. They could take cases away from them. They could reassign them. But the Supreme Court doesn't like to do that, especially Chief Justice Roberts. He's a particular kind of Chief Justice. He likes things to work in an orderly fashion. He likes to presume that all the federal judges are acting in good faith, despite the overwhelming evidence that that's not the case. They're acting explicitly in bad faith again and again and again. And it's just, we don't have a mechanism that allows for, we don't have a system that's designed to deal with a large number of federal judges acting in bad faith. Our founders just did not build a system for that. They presumed that we would not put people like that in positions of authority of federal judges with lifetime appointments. They would never have imagined, our founders would never have imagined, for example, that we could have in the D.C. District Court 15 federal district court judges, five of whom were not born in America. At least two of them maintained dual citizenship. I mean, to have people not born in America be given lifetime appointments as federal judges who believe, unbelievably, that they have the authority to order about, these unelected judges, to order about our democratically elected Article II executive branch president would be beyond the founders' imagining. But that's the world we've created for ourselves.
It is absolutely insane. And even the topic of lifetime appointments is not really a thing, right? I believe that was another video of yours. I watch a lot of your videos pretty much every time you crop up. I know I'm going to learn something. But I believe it was one of yours about the fact that there's nowhere it says a lifetime appointment. It says if they have good behavior, but it's never really defined what good behavior is. So it seems like you could, take that to mean that Trump could basically fire them at will. Is that right?
Well, I'm not sure Trump could, but I think there's an alternative way to remove judges from the bench other than impeachment. And that is Article 3 of the Constitution. We hold the political, what we call the political branches of government, Article 1, Congress, Article 2, the executive branch. We hold them accountable to the political will of the American people by having elections. We set terms of office and have elections. The Article 3 judiciary is supposed to be an apolitical branch of government, the least powerful, one that does not engage in policymaking. So we don't have a set term for those guys. But Article 3 does not literally say it's a lifetime appointment. It says judges serve during good behavior. Literally, that's Section 1 of Article 3. And we've just interpreted serve during good behavior to mean a lifetime appointment because we're presuming judges will act in good faith and serve with good behavior as federal judges. Again, it's a system that's not well suited to judges willing to act in bad faith. And I think if that's the condition of the Constitution and every word in the Constitution is presumed to mean something, to have meaning, it's not redundant. So this has to mean serve during good behavior, has to mean something different than impeachment, which is a separate power in the Constitution. If it means something different, well, then if a judge is not serving during good behavior, he no longer qualifies to serve on the bench. He can see just be fired. How was he hired in the first place? He was hired by a majority vote in the Senate. By my reading, he could be fired by a majority vote in the Senate, not for having committed a high crime and misdemeanor, not like you've committed a felony. That's why we're firing. You're just not doing your job. You're not being an impartial, unbiased jurist on the bench. And if you're not serving during good behavior, you're fired.
And some of these people, as you point out, I mean, they're literally not American. I mean, they're dual citizens or they're foreign born. A lot of them, I mean,
they're foreign born. They've all at least been naturalized citizens. But I have to be honest, in a lot of these cases, I consider, there's a difference between a cultural American citizen and a technical naturalized American citizen
who's
still
American,
culturally a member of his own foreign nationality. Like one of the judges that was admitted to the federal bench after Trump, a Biden judge, admitted, raised to the bench after Trump was elected, but before he was sworn in, I think he's the first Muslim judge on the D.C. Circuit, young guy. He wasn't born in America. He was born in Canada. He was born in Canada to Egyptian migrant parents. I mean, he's culturally Egyptian. And he moved to America. I think he got a citizenship naturalized like 5 years ago or 6 years ago. He's barely an American citizen. He's certainly not culturally an American citizen. And yet Biden gave that guy a lifetime appointment to the federal bench. It's outrageous.
And if you look at these guys' CVs, it's not like they were, a hot shot lawyer and then became a judge. A lot of them are literally just activists.
That's him.
Usually in like an NGO. Let's see, what did this guy do? He might have actually done something. But for a lot of these judges, I mean, they spend 20 years being a paid activist, getting more people into the country, using, their legal background in order to circumvent the immigration system and bring in as many immigrants as possible. After 20 years of that, they slap a robe on them and say, you're in charge now. It is absurd. And we've shown this data before where, under people like Bush and Obama, there would be like under 10 injunctions from judges. Under Trump, it's like 175. So it seems like that alone would be enough to say these judges are being biased. We don't have to listen to them because they're not actually acting in good faith. The numbers alone, I think, make that argument.
You know, the numbers raise a red flag, but it's theoretically, one thing we have to keep in mind in fairness is Trump is a much more aggressive executive than we've ever had, certainly in my lifetime. And when you're an executive, an aggressive executive, you're doing a lot of things that have not been done before. You're breaking norms. And that will lead to a lot of people to object and try to seek TROs and seek preliminary injunctions. So I think one of the reasons we're getting a lot of at least requests for them is because of the dramatic things that Trump is doing. But I read these arguments, and these arguments do not warrant the actual issuance of a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction. They're clearly being granted by these judges simply because these liberal judges, and by the way, they all come from a relatively small number of these federal judges. Now, all these cases are concentrated where these NGOs and these lawyers for terrorists know they can get assigned a liberal judge. And these liberal judges are just acting from pure political animus against the president. They're Trump deranged because we know this because they'll issue an injunction and get it rapidly overturned by the Court of Appeals. And then they'll just issue a second injunction and get it overturned and a third injunction on some other crazy legal theory. None of these are on the merits. We're just very fortunate that when it gets to the Court of Appeals, we have like a 50-50 chance of getting adults in the room to hold these feckless district trial court judges in check. And thank God when we get to the Supreme Court, we have a 5 or 6 justice majority that's, but of course, all of this consumes time, it consumes months, and they know this. So part of what they're doing is just acting as a brake on the Trump MAGA agenda and slowing everything down.
Yeah, it's absolutely infuriating. And as you point out, I mean, it is so undemocratic. I mean, for these people to, you know, be supporting this and employing this strategy when they spend the rest of their time crying about democracy and the norms. These are unelected people who I'd never even heard of before they issued these injunctions. How these random nobodies have the ability to override the president of the United States continuously about everything. It's infuriating. And I worry that it's not like on purpose because I'm to the point, I'm like a libertarian, right? I don't want the executive branch to have unchecked power. That's horrifying. But we're getting to the point where it's like we can't have these judges interfering. So it's almost like by using the judges so much and so inappropriately and they're so abusing their power, it's got people like me begging for an unaccountable executive branch. Obviously, I haven't gone that far, but that's the impulse. So it seems to me almost like if they mess things up this badly, then they'll just get what they want anyway, which is an unaccountable executive branch. Do you think that goes into the calculus at all?
Well, first of all, I would say, and listen, when I was a young man, I was a libertarian too. I've grown to believe that libertarianism is a luxury belief that America cannot afford in its current crisis. But having said that, President Trump, he's not unchecked. There's a ton of checks on his authority. Now, he controls all the executive authority. Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution says the executive authority of the government shall be vested in a president, a single president, one person. It's unique. In our constitutional order, right? We have the legislative branch, Article 1. There's hundreds of them, congressmen and senators. We have the Article 3 federal courts. There's at least 9 Supreme Court justices, and then there's 844. We distribute this power over a large number of people in Article 1 and Article 3. When it comes to Article 2, every scintilla of executive power is put in one president, and that's the way our founders designed the system. That's not an overreach of authority. That's the authority given to the president. And what doesn't he have? He doesn't have money. Congress controls the power of the purse. He's constrained by the actual Constitution. And that's enforced by the judiciary. For example, even these Trende Aragua terrorists, they are entitled to some due process of law. They don't get none. They get at least a habeas hearing. They have a right to be presented in front of a federal judge and have the government explain why they've been detained. Everybody in the U.S. has that right, including terrorists. In fact, the Alien Enemies Act, signed into law by John Adams, includes explicitly that little bit of due process, even for alien enemies of the United States. So there are constraints on the president's power. But the left doesn't like that he has any power. They want him to be the same flaccid executive that a John McCain would have been had he been elected, that a Mitt Romney would have been had he been elected. And Trump just does not give an F. He comes in like a bull. First elected office he's ever had as this president, and he's treating it like he is the CEO, the chief executive officer of the nation, which he damn well is. That's the job. That's how the Constitution defines it. And he's going to exercise his authority as he sees fit in the interests of the United States. But he's not unchecked.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wanted talk a little bit more about libertarianism, because it's sort of a loaded word. When I use it, I just mean, you know, liberty being my ultimate value, but with the understanding that you can't have liberty without peace and you can't have peace without order. So, you know, sort of taking it from a different angle. But what do you think has led you away from libertarianism? If you say you used to be more libertarianism, what sort of awakening have you gone through to drive you that way?
Well, I mean, the rest of the world, really. If we lived in a purely first world America, that appeared like our founders might have expected it to look when they created the nation, I think in that kind of sheltered environment, libertarianism can get some traction. But once it encounters a hostile third world, which is not only uninterested in respecting libertarian values, but is in my view, cognitively and temperamentally incapable of respecting libertarian views. I think it takes a certain minimum IQ to function in a libertarian mindset. And most of the world does not have that. We're all culturally conditioned to pretend for social purposes that, you know, everyone we meet is about as smart as we are. You know, we're not rude to people about such things. But the truth is, just fundamental IQ, the innate hardware ability of the brain to engage in problem solving, higher level thinking, it is not homogeneously distributed among all peoples. You can just get a map of IQ across the globe. And when you look at the first world nations, the single most defining characteristic is their high IQ. They have the highest IQ. I'm excluding Asia here because it's not really relevant to our discussion, but among non-Asian peoples, you look at a map of IQ, the countries that have 100 IQ or better on average are Europe, Russia, North America, Australia, places that people like our founders came from. 95, 100 IQ on average. You get to Central and South America, the average IQ drops to 80. You go to North Africa, the Middle East, India, it drops into the 70s. Mentally retarded to 75. Right. You get into sub-Saharan Africa, the average IQs drop into the 60s, sometimes the 50s. These are not people who can do the same things. It doesn't make them bad people. It doesn't make them less loved by God. But it's like you had different computers with different innate hardware capabilities. They're not the same. A Cray supercomputer, an AI, Grok, is not the same as the Commodore 64 that I had as a kid. It's just not. They're both computers, but they're not capable of the same things. So and I think libertarianism cannot survive in a world that's not a first world. And we don't live there. Only 8% of the population on the world is first world.
Yeah. No,
that's an environment that's very hostile to libertarianism.
I completely agree with you. Do you think there's a intelligence component to morals? Because that's what it seems like to me, that it's sort of the ability to see the second order effects and then to behave that way. Because it's interesting to me that, to me, you can't have liberty if you have people taking advantage of the vulnerabilities of a system, right? Liberty is to have a system that's vulnerable. And if you have people so sort of stupid and short-minded that they're going to, you know, take a shortcut when they ruin it for everybody else. What is the connection between intelligence and morality, do you think?
Well, first of all, for morality to have any meaning, it has to have some kind of biological anchor. Otherwise, it's just personal preference, right? What's immoral is things that I feel icky about. It's just completely relative and subjective. It's not useful. Sure. To me, what's moral behavior is behavior that advances the interest of your family, your tribe, your community, your nation, because that's what facilitates, I mean, just from an evolutionary biology perspective, that's what facilitates the propagation of what you are as a people, right? Your genetic code. But that works at a lot of levels of sophistication. I mean, a primitive tribe might fight with another tribe. They're acting out of their own moral interest. But it may be very tribal, which is what we see from the third world today. It's a very tribal existence. With higher IQ comes a more sophisticated understanding of what it means to be moral. We look out for a broader circle of people, not just our family, not just our immediate tribe, but our county, our state, our nation. We believe we're one people, right? E pluribus unum. We're all acting with a common shared interest. I think it takes a higher level of intelligence to expand morality in that way.
I knew this conversation was going to get interesting. More with Andrew F. Branca on the other side at The Branca Show on X, youtube.com/The Branca Show. I'm telling you, the guy knows his stuff. We'll be right back with more. Don't go anywhere.
My Pillow alone, just My Pillow, not counting me, it cost them over $200 million directly related to Arctic frost, everybody. What they've done to my company, trying to just wipe them off the face of the earth because I'm out there going, we need to secure our elections. We need to secure our election. We need to get rid of the machines. We need to go to paper ballots.
You were literally terrorized and targeted, and it's in the documents.
And that thing goes so deep. It's funny, Alex. Things go so far, and then they tend to get stopped. But you guys, just know, I am never stopping. I will never stop. Number one, my number one thing is we need to secure our election platform.
Let's talk about this. People supporting what you're doing and getting the highest quality, you name it, great products. Almost all of it made in America. Your great Giza sheets have that special cotton everybody knows comes from Egypt, but you're amazing. Right. I've got some on my king bed. Talk about the incredible products you've got at mypillow.com/Alex. And again, I want to be clear. We are only here still hanging on, but now people support at theAlexShowStore.com or at MyPillow.com/Alex is absolutely critical. This is now literally up to you every month whether we're going to stay in this fight. We're both workaholics. We love people. We love telling the truth. You know, these corrupt people, you know, think we're schmucks because we're not corrupt. No, we know how to be corrupt if we wanted to, dumbasses. But we like being good people. That's what builds a society.
We're the tip of the spear. This is it. We only get one shot at this. And like I said, about 2 years ago, they said, Mike, would you, if you could turn back time here and go back, and if you wanted to spoke out about the election, wouldn't stand your ground. You know, look what they've destroyed, tried to destroy you. I said, I would never change a thing knowing what I know and knowing what this is critical. And that's where we're at. And it's because of all of you, because you buy our products. And that's why we're putting right now on sale our five flagship products. We have five flagship products, our biggest products of all time. For you go to mypillow.com/Alex, and you guys are going to see we've got the Giza Dream Sheets. If you put that thing up there, these are all for Christmas presents. You guys, you can get the best Christmas presents ever. The Giza Dream Sheets, the towels, the slippers. On the MyPillow Premiums, we've sold 85 million MyPillows because they work. You save over 50% on those, and then the mattress toppers made in the USA, $149.98, as low as that, depending on the size. But we got in the premium My Towels that actually work. You save 50% there, $39.98. And here's one of my favorites, the My Slippers. Best slippers in history. They're normally $149.98, $39.98. And once they're gone, they're gone. We can't get those back. They're made with impact gel, made out of soybeans. And so you walk on them, and it's like walking on a cloud. It's absolutely awesome, this patented gel that's in there. And then you have the Giza Dream Sheets. It's my favorite product. It's our president's favorite product. And not as low as $29.98. And I'm going to show you one more. You guys go there, and you're getting five of these Bible pillows. These are very dear to me. They've got stories on the back. You get basically five Christmas gifts for $29.98 for all five. You got the baby Jesus, Noah's Ark, Daniel in the Lion's Den, but you get all five of them. So you get five individual gifts for under $6 a piece. Free shipping, promo code Alex on your entire order. No matter what you are, this is an exclusive free shipping on your entire order. So go to mypillow.com/Alex, and it's a win-win-win. You guys are supporting my employee-owned company. You're getting the best products at the best prices in history. You're supporting this great, Alex's great show. I'll tell you, Alex, I can't be prouder, just more proud than anyone that support your show and what you put out and help save this country more than anyone, and I mean that.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, InfoWars.com, band.video. Share those links. My guest in this final hour is Andrew F. Branca. He's the host of The Branca Show, providing pro-America, pro-Constitution, pro-Western civilization, political and legal analysis. Plus, he's funny. He's got the jokes and laughter to come along with it. The Branca Show on X and YouTube.com/@TheBrancaShow. So I know you've said after the first question I asked that you just sort of noticed things and you were confused why nobody else was noticing them or something like that. And that's sort of been the theme of my entire episode today, especially talking about this Lost Generation story from Compact Magazine, where it's like suddenly everybody realizes that blatantly discriminating against white people isn't a good thing. And I have this mix of like, I'm glad people are talking about it. Good. This article is wonderful and, you know, really has some important information, but it's mixed with a frustration that nobody can see this for themselves and they have to have an article written for them. It's obvious that it's bad to discriminate against a group of people. What is wrong with everybody? Help me wrap my mind around this, Andrew. It's like, why is it so hard for people to see what's happening right in front of them?
Well, I think for different people, it's different reasons, right? I mean, DEI, for example, discriminating against white men is not bad for everybody in the near term. A lot of people get hired into jobs they wouldn't otherwise, well, they're not qualified for, but they wouldn't be eligible for. They're making money. They're building careers. They get to act as if they're superior in some way because after all, they have those job positions. So they feel good about it. It's a better quality of life for them. They don't see, it's like someone who doesn't really know how to play chess. They can't see five or six moves ahead. They're living in the moment, almost like your dog lives in the moment. There's no foresight there into what the future will look like. So right now things are happy for them and they're happy to have it that way. They don't understand that virtually everything in life that we consider of value to us in improving our quality of life, was invented by first world white dudes, virtually all of it. And we just take that all for granted. But the norm for human existence is abject poverty. And then in the modern era, we had the first world adopt things like the scientific method and reason and mathematics and apply it to a world of scarce resources to bring enormous wealth to everybody on the planet. But they're unable to see, or they can't for emotional reasons, see that the goose that laid the golden egg, continues to lay the golden egg, is not them. It's somebody else. It's a different culture than theirs. And that is, I think, in a sense, for many of these people, a humiliating experience. Of course, in any demographic, there are exceptional individuals. Every demographic on the planet has some geniuses in it. But when we're talking about large groups of numbers, you have to presume you're going to get something close to the average of what that particular demographic represents. There's a reason the third world looks like the third world. And there's a reason Central and South America look like they do. And there's a reason that Sub-Saharan Africa looks like it does. And it's not the geography. It's just not. It's the culture, and the culture is a reflection, at least in large part, of the IQ of those peoples. And we know this because if we take people from the first world, if we take people from Europe, and we drop them into the worst geography on the planet, places like Sub-Saharan Africa, suddenly we have a first world culture there. We have Rhodesia, we have white South Africa. And then when those people, those first world people are driven out, it reverts back to its previous third world status before. So within our own lifetimes, well, at least within my lifetime, we have that history to look at. And I think it's really a reflection. I always tell my audience, it's always the same map. When you're confused about right. what's driving some social complexity or unpleasantness, just look at the world IQ map, and right. it really explains everything.
I was actually going to mention that in the last segment, the meme of there's one map. It's the same for everything. Development or like marrying your cousin you do a heat map over the world and you find clusters in all the typical areas. And I had
whether it's poverty, whether how much trash there is in the environment. I mean, these are all reflections of the culture itself. And I think probably the single strongest driver of the nature of a culture is the average IQ of the population.
But you know what's bizarre is then you've got, you know, people that I think are sincere in their motives in America. They, you know, truly believe in global warming or whatever it is. They want to fight climate change. But then they're completely blind to it when you have China with these fishing fleets that are just destroying life in the oceans systematically as much as they possibly can. And that's what I don't understand, where it's like, okay, these people are high IQ. They are, you know, cognizant and aware of what's going on in general, but they just have this like imposed block that provides this cognitive dissonance where they cannot see the stupidity of offshoring all of our manufacturing to China, who has no environmental controls because of our environmental controls here. Like, it seems like they have the IQ sufficient to understand that, but they can't. And that's what I have trouble like wrapping my head around. Is it fear? Right. Are they lying?
No, they're acting like normal human beings. So you have to think of IQ as like a toolbox, right? You have a box full of tools that you can use. And the higher your IQ, the more tools you have and the more sophisticated those tools are. But that's not the person. The tools are just things the person can use to try to control, manage better their environment. Human beings are not intrinsically beings of reason. We're beings of emotion. Mm-hmm. And then we try to apply a facade of reason because it helps us better improve our world, helps our children survive. But we all know if someone's in a panic state, their powers of reason go right out the window. And so the kind of people you're talking about are just acting like normal human being, but they're succumbing to their emotional drivers. And it's wiping away that veneer of reason. They believe in things like global warming, and they probably believe in that as strongly as I believe in my faith. But that's what it is. For them, that's an article of faith. You could never reason them out of that belief. It doesn't matter how much evidence you show them. They didn't reason themselves into that position, so you can't reason them out of it. And because they're acting in an emotional way, it doesn't matter how big their toolbox is. They're just the toolbox has become invisible to them.
Mm. That makes a lot of sense. That is absolutely true. I mean, we know physiologically, like, you cannot think clearly if you're in a state of fear. So that's why it's so useful to create that state of fear if you're trying to pull one over on everybody.
Right.
And when it gets to Africa, I agree with you that there's almost this like seething resentment, that the first world exists and that they're not a part of it. But then it gets even further than that. Like, there's something else going on here. I have this from yesterday. This is the co-founder of the EFF party, which is the party you see walking around there chanting, kill the Boer, kill the white people. I guess he's in some new party now, but he's a politician in South Africa. And he responds to a post about Aranya saying, count your days, Aranya. You will be history soon. Right. So here's this group that takes over South Africa, decides they, you know, don't want white people in charge. The white people that aren't okay with that go, fine, we're leaving. They leave off to the wilderness, create their own community from scratch. Now the South Africans are saying, we're going to come and destroy that too. They don't even want it. It's not even like they're like, we want that. They just want to destroy it. That's the psychology that, again, I think begs an explanation. What is it about seeing other people succeed that just makes them want to destroy it? It's totally foreign to me.
But this only confuses civilized people. when I was a kid, probably when you were a kid, most of us, when we were kids in school, we may have gotten bullied. And we might have thought, why can't I reason with this bully? Why can't I just talk him, explain to him why what he's doing is unreasonable? There's no need for this. We could get along. And the bully just punches you anyway. It's a very primitive emotion to do that. And that's the same primitive emotion happening here. The black South Africans cannot allow white South Africans to live with them because the difference in the standard of living will be so profound they can't explain it away. Well, if we're as good, how come we can't do those same things? They can't do the same things because they're not as good, not as humans, but just in terms of, again, IQ, problem-solving ability to work cooperatively, to not have a exploitative third-world low-trust kind of culture where everything is stolen. I mean, there's very basic aspects of the third world that Americans don't even think about. Even in America, we have low-trust communities, right? So if you live in a high-trust community, if your kid leaves his bicycle in the front yard, you have a reasonable expectation it'll still be there an hour later, right? Amazon delivers a package to your doorstep. It's probably going to be there when you get home from work. But there are large areas and communities in America where that's not true. I've lived in them. You leave your bike out in the front yard, it's gone in 3 minutes. You can't have packages delivered to your house because they're stolen as soon as anybody sees them. Well, that's what those are third world communities within America, low trust third world communities. And that's the entire third world is like that. That's what their culture is. So little things like trying to engage in construction, you can't leave construction materials unattended. They'll all get stolen. I mean, you're lucky if buildings don't get pulled apart from the materials they're made out of. Anything that's left unattended for even a moment. And from the people, the perspective of the people stealing it, they don't even feel a moral qualm about it. From their perspective, they would be fools not to take advantage of this opportunity to enrich them and theirs by simply taking these resources.
And in a way, it's sort of a self-fulfilling thing, right? Because if you get a critical mass of those types of people, then you are kind of an idiot if you don't take advantage of vulnerabilities, right? If
you need 1%, 1% of them in it. Because, I mean, just think about it. You live in a nice first world high trust community, right? Your kid's left his bikes out. It's never been stolen. You never had a package taken. If one family moves into that neighborhood that is willing to steal your kid's bike or take your packages or take stuff out of your garage if you happen to leave your garage door open, how long does it take before you realize you can't do those things anymore? You have to make sure the bike's not in the yard, that packages are delivered elsewhere, that you keep your garage doors closed. One family turns the whole community into a low-trust community.
Or, you know, in another instance, if one group of people is hiring their ethnic cohort and discriminating against everybody else, and you don't do that, you're kind of out of luck. It kind of compels you that, I guess, if everybody else is doing it, I have to too. So it's this feedback loop of immorality that once it starts going, it's really hard to stop it. Once people start taking advantage of this stuff, it's really hard to convince
anyone. It's very fragile, this first world culture we've built, where we can presume that in general, not everybody, of course, even first world countries have their bad actors, but in general, people will act in good faith. That there's people will follow the golden rule, that your stuff's not going to be stolen the instant you turn your back. In general, we have that in first world cultures in America. But it's extremely fragile, and it's lost like that. And now we're living in an America, 300 million people, roughly 340 million people, and we've imported into our fragile first world culture tens of millions of people from the third world who don't share that culture. And I'm not saying this to say they're bad people. They're just human beings from a low trust culture. And by neither inclination, temperament, or frankly, I think ability, are they likely to assimilate into a first world culture? It just doesn't happen. All the data tells us, two generations, three generations, four generations in, it hasn't changed. America has some success with a lot of work in assimilating migrants from other first world European countries. America's brought in immigrants from Italy and Poland and Germany, similar religious backgrounds, similar understanding of the role of the person to the state and how people should interact with each other in a golden rule sense. We have zero history of success in successfully assimilating any substantial numbers of people from the third world, any. And that's because they're so different from us.
And if there's no motive to, like, if there's no compulsion to integrate, why would you? I mean, when you drop 50,000 Somalis off in one area, they're going to maintain their behavior that they were in Somalia. Their family is all there, and it's very easy to silo yourself off. And that's a great example of exactly what you're talking about. We bring in all these Somalis. What happens 10 years later? There's $80 billion of fraud having been committed. And then when Ilhan Omar, the most prominent and visible leader of this community, is asked about it, she says it's the government's fault for not having better guardrails to stop the fraud. Right. So it's like,
but from her view, that's true. That's true. It would be like if you or I had a bag of money, right? A paper bag with $10,000 in it. And we just set it out in a parking lot someplace with lots of people. We wouldn't expect it to be left there. All right. People would say you're an idiot for doing that. But high trust cultures are very vulnerable to exploitation by low trust cultures because we don't set up the guardrails you would need to deal with a low trust. It takes a lot of effort and energy to do that, to presume that everybody you interact with is trying to steal from you. It would be like having a social welfare program that was a convenience store with bulletproof glass and everything's locked up in a cabinet. We don't do that unless we need to. And if we're providing those services to high trust people, we don't need to. So we don't put those protections in place. But if a third world person comes in, it's like they're walking into one of these honor farm stands, you know, where you take a head of corn and you leave a dollar and everyone trusts each other. And they're like, well, I can just take the corn. I don't have to pay. Why wouldn't I do that? When these Somalians come in and they say, holy cow, we could steal $1 billion and without much effort, no one would even notice until long enough for us to get away with it. Why wouldn't they do that? So when Ilhan Omar says, well, it's your fault, you didn't put enough protections in, from her cultural perspective, she's 100% correct.
That really is a good way. That is a good way of putting it. Yeah, you just left a bag of money out. Of course it's going to get taken. Are you an idiot?
Right.
That, yeah, that's exactly how it is. And again, it's not even like you're even judging, you know, these people's cultures. It's literally just a fact. This is what the cultures are like. And I reference all the time videos of like Indian politicians that are driving around neighborhoods just throwing cash out the window because they're like, yeah, this is how you win the election. You bribe your electorate. And to us, that would be so offensive. With this voting is this sacred thing that you're supposed to vote on your conscience. To them, they're like, no, he paid me the most. Of course he's the best candidate. If I vote for him, he might pay me more. It's not like they're ashamed about this. It's not like they're hiding this. It's just, this is the way it is.
It would never occur to them to be ashamed about it. They just don't have that kind of code of conduct, of behavior, of culture.
And that's fine for them, but like you bring it over here, it's completely incompatible. And then you even just have to look at our next door neighbor, Mexico, to see a world where you have to bribe every police officer you come in contact with. You have to, you know, be constantly bending the rules or trying to figure out what the, it's exhausting. And I completely agree with you. It's a point I make quite a bit that the American people are not aware of the value of the thing that we're losing. This high trust society is not something that we can just recreate, you know, in a couple years. It took us 2000 years to develop this, this civilization and this society. And yet we're destroying it in a generation. It's sort of terrifying, actually.
Yeah, these high trust qualities, I think of them as like oil in an engine, right? It's what allows the engine to run efficiently. Right. You ever heard an engine run without enough oil in it? You know, that's a bad day. But that's how third world cultures run. They don't have oil in them. And that's why they run so inefficiently. You have to take bribes. All your stuff is being stolen. You have to worry everyone you interact with is going to rip you off. The first world cultures were literally smart enough to say, hey, we could be a lot more efficient at all this if we didn't have to deal with all of that. Let's add some oil to the system. Plus, in Europe, in the Middle Ages, they were very aggressive about removing from the gene pool people who were social bad actors. They executed about 1% of the population every year, took their worst psychopaths, their worst actors out of the gene pool. And you do that over, you know, it's hard to affect the gene pool, but you do it over a couple hundred years, you'll have a real effect. It's a multi-generational effect. The third world doesn't do that. And so it almost concentrates bad actors within those populations.
Yeah. And again, it's, if everybody's living that way and you're living that way, okay, fine. It's not the way I'd want to live, but you can at least survive. It's when you try to mix the high trust and the low trust that the high trust people just get destroyed and don't even know why it's happening because they, you know, they likewise can't conceive of the mindset of the low trust people.
You know, the funny thing is, of course, that they really know that it sucks to live in a first world culture. I mean, we don't have tens of millions of Americans trying to live in India. We have tens of millions of Indians trying to live in America. And their worst nightmare, you talk to an Indian in America, their worst nightmare is that they might be returned to India.
Right.
They love living in a first world culture because it is great. It's clean. People are generally honest. They know what it's like in India. They don't want to go back there. And by the way, I don't say any of this to be derogatory to any of these other cultures. I wish nothing but the greatest success for them. I wish India, I wish they were all billionaires. Sub-Saharan Africans, I hope they all become billionaires. I'm just pointing out that those cultures do not integrate or assimilate with first world cultures. And so when we import large numbers of them, not the top 1%, not just the geniuses, that's not what we're doing. Those people exist in those populations, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about bringing in large numbers of people. You have to expect to get close to the average of what those people represent. That's a problem. That's a huge problem for our nation because we end up with a balkanized country and an utter destruction, poisoning of our own first world culture.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. And again, you know, if you bring over just the top 0.01% of a country, they're probably going to have a high enough IQ and they're going to come in low enough numbers that it's fine. It's not destabilizing. But then when you bring over the population transfer like they're doing, it's obviously not going to work. Shifting gears just a little bit and going back to what we were talking about earlier in this hour and trying to connect it all. The Compact Magazine article talks about the way that obviously this diversity trend is destroying America. These institutions that have adopted it are cratering and collapsing. And yet it's all sort of predicated on this bizarre distortion of capitalism. And maybe it's my conspiratorial mind, but it seems like the push is to destroy the reputation of capitalism. And the people that are imposing DEI know how destructive it is, and they're doing it so they can say, see, capitalism doesn't work. We need a new system. What do you think the how likely do you think that scenario is? What do you think of the state of capitalism today as we see so many young people abandoning capitalism and going towards socialism?
I think it's a very complicated, multivariant question, because I think different actors involved in these conversations have their own different perceptions, their own different drivers. Anyone who knows anything knows that capitalism is the only way to create wealth. So people advocating for socialism, they're doing it from the privileged position of living in a capitalist country. Right. The people that advocate DEI and these giant corporations, they can get away with it because they're working in the privileged position of a corporation that makes a ton of money thanks to capitalism and can afford, at least in the short term, the drag that DEI imposes. So they don't really want socialism, at least if they knew what they were talking about, if they knew what that existence would be like. Socialism is poverty everywhere. You look at the Scandinavian countries, they're not really socialist. They're capitalist countries. People there make a lot of money. The top echelon make a lot of money from their natural resources, the gas and oil in the North Sea and elsewhere. And then they have huge social safety networks. But they're not socialist. They're capitalist countries. It's the only way to make money. But if you make enough money, you can afford a lot of drag, right? You can have a very draggy boat, but you put enough engines on it, it'll still go quick.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I just think it's a failure of the Republican Party mostly to actually make the argument for capitalism, because it seems to me like the only people talking about the economic woes of the average young person now is somebody who's just socialist going, hey, see that billionaire? I'll take his money and give it to you. And for people that are just, they just want, you know, to get their feet under them, that's fine, whatever it takes. So I worry about that, trajectory that it's going.
Well, the Republican Party sucks.
Well, yeah, I know.
They suck. They're 1 degree less sucky than the Democrats. That's the best I can say for them.
So what do we do about that? I know we only have 2 minutes, Lee, here. You're not going to solve our political crisis in 2 minutes, but what do we do about the Republicans?
Yeah, MAGA. We have to envision a MAGA party, an American First party, not as a third party. Third parties don't work in America. But we have to do what Trump started, which is basically to co-opt the traditional GOP and take it over as a MAGA party. We need to demand from candidates that they're talking the MAGA talking points. We're stopping this H-1B nonsense. We're getting rid of these migrants. A lot of the stuff that Trump is already doing and talking about, that we're careful about the kind of federal judges we pick. People have to be saying the right things. And a lot of it's going to be new, by the way, because anyone who's been in the GOP is corrupted already by the system. So a lot of these are going to be new candidates without a lot of track record. They need to be saying the right things. And then, of course, the proof is in the pudding. They need to do the right things once they're in. And then we need to be absolutely vicious about holding accountable those that don't do that. But part of that is we have to have options. We have to have a lot of candidates going into place. We have to encourage people to run for office at every level of government as MAGA candidates. Otherwise, we're just going to lose the war. It's like if you want to win a war, but you don't have anyone willing to fight. What's the point? You may as well save yourself a lot of trouble and just lose. But I heard your comments about that article before we started. A lot of people feel like they've lost already. They've given up. And that's one way to go. That's not my way. My way is I'd rather fight and die in the fight than just give up and lay down.
Hey, if you're going to kill me, you're going to have to try really hard. I'm not just going to lay down and let you do it. And I think you find once you stand up, it's not only do you not die, you can actually win. It's actually incredible. This has been awesome. We could talk for hours. Andrew F. Barca has been my guest Bronca. And am I pronouncing that right? Bronca?
Yeah, that's fine. Don't worry about it.
Bronca. It's B-R-A-N-C-A. Andrew F. Bronca. The Bronca Show. YouTube.com/The Bronca Show. Thank you so much for being here with us. Keep up the fantastic work, sir. Amazing stuff. All right, folks. That's going to do it for us. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Make sure to go to thealexjonesstore.com today to keep us on the air, in the fight, and winning incredible victories.
Real quick, I just wanted to plug the Methylene Blue. I'm a new supplement buyer from Alex Jones Store, and I keep hearing people talking about the Methylene Blue, and I'm like, you know what? I don't know what the hype is all about, but I definitely want to try it. And what I noticed is I didn't get the sensations that a lot of the other people said that they got, you know, like the tingling fingers and like this, you know, euphoria. But I do have an ample amount of energy, and I'm disabled, so I'm a housewife, and whenever you're at home day in and day out, 7 days a week, it really tends to drag after some time. And there were things that I wasn't doing around the house that I should have. But now I'm getting things done like really quick. I have all this extra time on my hands now. And I really think it's the Methylene Blue that's been giving me the energy. And it's so funny because now like my silly husband's calling me a meth head, which is hilarious. But yeah, so I'm going to stick on that. And I actually have some bovine coming in today, so I can't wait to try that out. I'm also going to give that to my dog because, you know, I need a lot of help too. And I brought online that's really good for your dog if you give them, like, a small little amount of the food. So I'm going to do that. But, yeah, I just thought I would tell you guys about my experience with this so far. So,
well, Jen, thank you. That's amazing to hear, and we love to hear that, honestly. I mean, that's the reason why Alex has created the shop, so people can get, you know, get healthier and not be relying on big pharmaceutical companies, but instead take control of their health. So that's good to hear. You know, I fluctuated weight-wise too. And so finding something that works is really important. And not to get hooked on those, like, high caffeine, insane chemicals, energy drinks, which so much of us have relied on over the years. I literally was getting anxiety from one of them. And so I too am on the blue these days. So I guess your husband would call me a meth head, but, it's good to hear from you, Jen. I love it. I think it's great. And I love to hear from you as well.